Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. The purpose of this meeting is to talk about the straw proposal. This is for the Regional Integration California Greenhouse Gas Compliance, as well as the EIM Greenhouse Gas Enhancements Initiative. The EIM component was added recently, and Don will talk more about that at the beginning of his presentation. So we published this proposal November 17th. It is out on our website. We also published the slides yesterday. We apologize for the delay. Don Trethewey was needed at the EIM Regional Issues Forum, so he was out part of the week. But we did publish the slides yesterday. Those are available on the initiative webpage. Go to the Stay Informed tab and select Stakeholder Processes, and you'll find this initiative linked on that page. After I'm done with the introductions, I'm going to turn it over to Don, and for the better part of the morning, he's going to talk about the proposed changes to the GHG design. We'll break for lunch for about an hour. When we return, George Angelides is actually going to walk through the illustrative examples. This is the comparison of the current GHG design with the proposed two-path solution. After that, Don is going to talk about the implications to a multi-state BAA, and then I'll finish it with next steps. We will take questions throughout the meeting today, so if you do have a question on the phone, press pound 2. And in the room, just go ahead and raise your hand. We do have quite a bit of folks that participate on the web, so I'd just like to remind you to please identify yourself before asking your question. We greatly appreciate it. So as I mentioned, we are in the straw proposal phase of the stakeholder process. We are taking stakeholder comments after the meeting. Those are going to be due December 15th. We'll take a break for the holidays, and then the plan is to post a draft final proposal January 5th, and followed by a stakeholder call on January 12th. I'll review the next steps at the end of the meeting as well. So with that, I'll just go ahead and turn it over to Don.
So good morning, everybody. So I figured I'd start the morning with why we actually merged these two issues together into a single stakeholder initiative. And the first is the concerns that the California Air Resources Board has raised with the energy imbalance market design. One of the ways that we have to actually solve that problem is to move away from this paradigm that the California ISO Balancing Authority area equals California. And that is really the same issue we were tackling as part of regional integration, because under regional integration we become a multi-state balancing authority area. And so we'll get into this in more detail later in the presentation, but one of the key elements in the design changes we're proposing for EIM is you have to identify what is California supply when doing the first pass of the two-pass solution. And this definition of California supply, just as today, it can include resources that are not actually located within California. You could have imports from other balancing authority areas. You could also have contracts with resources in an EIM entity balancing authority area. You could have a contract within a multi-state balancing authority area that's located in a state that's not California. And we'll get, again, more detail why that's important. And so since we've addressed that, really, which was the core issue we brought up as part of the issue paper on regional integration, the only real thing that you're doing is you move to a multi-state balancing authority area is extending the same approach into the day-ahead market. So I'll pause and answer any questions on that. Why we joined the two. So seeing none in the room, I'll go to the phone real quick.
And just a reminder, if you're on the phone, you can press pound 2 to enter the queue.
Okay, so moving forward, what I'll do is I'll sort of frame up the issue we're trying to address, and then we'll walk through the solutions, or potential solutions we reviewed at the technical workshop a while back, and then the option 2 that we've actually chosen to move forward with. One of the key things to remember is that all kinds of things can contribute to the optimal dispatch. We can have changes in load within the EIM balancing authority areas. There's non-participating resources that are changing their output. We have participating resources that submit a GHG bid. We have those that do not submit a GHG bid, which means they're not eligible to be attributed coming to California. We have ISO load, ISO resources, and we optimize all of these at the same time. So we're not solving, an incremental dispatch. We're not doing anything, not solving California and then solving Nevada currently, or solving an EIM entity separately. And that's because the current design of the EIM extends the ISO's full real-time market to other balancing authority areas. And by doing that, the EIM then redispatches all of the resources in the combined ISO and EIM BAA footprint simultaneously. We are balancing total supply versus total demand, not changes from some starting point. Everything's redispatched basically from zero. And the objective of the market optimization is to minimize the total overall costs while recognizing all of the various constraints on the system, transmission, resource constraints, et cetera. Okay? So some observations from that dispatch are that the least cost dispatch can have the effect of sending low emitting resources to the ISO while not accounting for a secondary dispatch or the backfill that occurs to serve external demand. And this is logical because in California there's a premium in essence for clean resources because that lowers the overall production costs when those are serving California, because there's not a compliance obligation when they're serving load outside of California. So you can have instances, and it's a little difficult to see whether it's really this backfill effect is increasing or decreasing emissions, and we'll walk through that in a second. And that's what makes solving this problem a little challenging, is that you need to make sure that you understand any solution that you're making sure that you're trying to capture that atmospheric effect that happens as a result of a transfer coming to California. And it should also be noted that one of the additional benefits of the energy imbalance market is that you can integrate even more renewables, which are zero emitting resources, because you have a larger geographic footprint by which to balance that intermittency. And so you can have, as a result of being able to avoid curtailments of ISO resources, you can actually displace emitting resources outside of California, which lowers the overall carbon impact of the entire West. So we have been working with ARB to address the concerns that can the least cost dispatch result in where the attribution doesn't capture what the atmospheric effect is of when there is a transfer to California. And there's a question in the room.
Kevin Woodruff, consultant for TURN. The word sending, is that like, that's not a, you don't mean physically sending, is that like more like attribution?
It's more like, it's attribution,
okay,
correct. We do not track electrons.
Okay, thank you.
Question. I'm Doug Marker with Bonneville Power Administration. In your statement about the effect of this causing the dispatch of carbon-emitting resources elsewhere, how well established is that? How transparent is that? Are you able to quantify it after the fact?
Can you ask that again? I missed the first part.
I'm sorry. What I was asking about is your ability to, at this point, look at what has happened after the fact and document the extent of the issue that you're describing.
So it is very difficult to do the effect of the secondary dispatch, and you'll see that in the upcoming example that I'm going to walk through, that it may look like there's a secondary dispatch, but it actually isn't changing the atmospheric effects. So we haven't quantified the total magnitude of secondary dispatch, but again, we do recognize that from an accounting standpoint, from a GHG accounting standpoint, that we can improve upon what the current methodology is doing, and that's what that option two does, is it does improve because it does try to address these instances where there is a backfill of an emitting resource that otherwise wouldn't have generated but for California's load being served by it. And then we have put out reports regarding the second bullet on here, where we show basically we determine the counterfactual of what the emissions, or and can show what the emissions reductions were outside of California as a result of not having to curtail renewables internal to the ISO. And that's been posted, and there's a, I can give you the link if you can't find it. Are there any questions on the phone?
Lauren, you can go ahead and open up the phone line. Just a reminder to please identify yourself first. Lauren, do we have a question in the queue?
Yes, I have opened the line.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi, this is Ayaz Osman from the CPUC ORA. The term that you have on your slide stating GHG attribution captures the atmospheric effect.
Mm-hmm.
Can you clarify what that means? Atmospheric effects is global, so I'm still trying to understand what does that mean. I mean, ARB is addressing the concern of attribution to California, yes, but the GHG effect is global, regardless where it occurs.
Mm-hmm. So that term basically...
Yeah, can you clarify that
yeah,
term?
So attribution captures the atmospheric effects. So currently, the ISO market optimization identifies through attribution, through the market optimization, which resource is serving a transfer into the ISO. And the question is, have you accurately accounted for the emissions associated with that transfer? So what can happen is, since we're doing a least cost dispatch and a non-emitting resource has a zero cost of zero GHG cost, it is cheaper to serve California load than an emitting resource, all else being equal. But there may be instances where that non-emitting resource would have generated already or was serving a base schedule and its output didn't change. It was already serving load externally. The market would attribute the transfer to that resource, but what the atmosphere felt was the other resource that was then emitting that had to be dispatched up to serve the California load. And so the atmospheric effect is the carbon emitting resource whose output is increased that supports the transfer, not the non-emitting resource that was already generated. Does that help?
Yeah, I understand the concept, but the example that you're giving is in both cases, the non-emitting resource is already dispatched, whether it's backfilled California to mm-hmm. ISO or not, right? It's already dispatched, and the atmospheric effect already happened. Is that correct?
I think the question is the which resource was dispatched up to serve California, and in certain instances, it can be the emitting. The emitting resource outside of California.
I understand that. I am not agreeing with the term capturing the atmospheric effects. The reason is that the non-emitting resource, whether it's backfilled to serve California or not, has already been dispatched and the atmospheric effect already happened. This sentence is kind of misleading because what we want to say is how ARB is going to attribute the effect in California.
So the ISO market does the attribution, and the key here is that, but for the transfer to California, that emitting resource outside of California would not have generated, and there would not have been an atmospheric effect of that carbon. That's what we're trying to capture and make sure
Okay, so you're saying that additional resource would not have been dispatched otherwise?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So,
thanks.
As I highlighted earlier, this atmospheric effect is not always apparent when the GHG is attributed to a base schedule. And again, a base schedule is used for settlement purposes. It's the initial schedule that an EIM entity and all resources within an EIM entity balancing authority area submit, and it's the baseline from which we measure imbalances for settlement purposes. But again, there is no requirement that an individual balancing authority area in the EIM has optimized their base schedules. There's no way to have optimized across multiple balancing authority areas until you actually get into the energy imbalance market. So you can't use this base schedule as the baseline from which to determine what is the incrementally dispatched resource to serve a transfer into California. And as we highlighted, if the attributed resource would have generated anyways to serve load outside of California, then another resource's emissions may be higher than what was attributed to California. So how can you capture that and ensure that the market optimization can take that into consideration? But if the attributed resource, even though it was previously scheduled to run, would not have generated to serve ISO demand, then that resource's emissions are the correct atmospheric effect, because in essence, that's the one who's been whose dispatch is supporting the transfer to California. Okay, so now I'm going to go through the question in the room.
Hi, this is Stephanie Johnson from Seattle City Light. I'm just wondering, can you explain to me what you mean, then another resource's emissions may be higher? Under the first bullet?
Well, again, in the first bullet, let's say I attributed it to a solar resource, the other resource that could have been moved was a hydro resource. Then the emissions output is exactly the same. You know, it was a non-emitting to a non-emitting. But it could also have been a gas unit that was inked up to backfill the non-emitting being attributed to California. So that's the point, is you don't know currently what the exact resource that backfilled the one that was attributed to California. So it could be another non-emitting resource. It could be load dropping. You don't know what's the emissions of that. Okay. Are there any questions on the phone? Okay. All right. So we walked through this before. I'm not going to go through the pricing exactly on this, but the key here is that we've got two resources, G1 and G3, that are outside of California. They're willing to be deemed delivered to California, and you can see we're using the base schedules. So all four of these balancing authority areas are balanced, which is one of the rules of the EIM. You have to come to the start of the EIM with balanced load and supply and demand within your balancing authority area. So you can see that G1 is serving load in PacWest, and G3, it's not even dispatched. It's basically at zero because that balancing authority area has decided that from a starting point, they have all this other generation that's actually going to need load. Okay? And then the green lines reflect the ability to transfer capability between each of the balancing authority areas. So when we do the EIM, this is the result that we would see. We would see that since load in California can be served cheaper externally, we would see 200 megawatts come into the ISO from PacWest. And since G1 is a non-emitting resource, there is no GHG cost associated with that transfer. So we would attribute the emissions to G1. We would then see that the only resource that was actually incremented from that base schedule, again, the one that's used just from settlements, was actually G3. So G3 went from 0 to 200, and it is an emitting resource. So from an atmospheric effect, California load's going up 200 megawatts, and generator 3, which is emitting, is going up 200 megawatts. So the question is that secondary dispatch such that that is what the atmospheric effect is of the California dispatch? Is it really G3, even though we attributed it to G1? Question in the room.
Kevin Woodruff again.
Yep.
The logic here is that the PacEast generator would click on, even though it's $36 a megawatt hour to displace $40 megawatt hour load in the ISO. Is that the logic, or is it?
What the logic is that you can get $35 power from PacWest.
Okay.
And then you can take that PacWest, and then you can still serve that with G3 economically.
Right. And going PacEast to PacWest, the $6 GHG bid is ignored.
Right.
Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
Right. And there's a question on the phone. Okay.
Lauren will take the question in the queue.
Hi, this is Ezra Hausman on behalf of the Sierra Club. On this example, I was looking at this. I'm wondering why G1 is not dispatched to 201 megawatts. Then you'd have the line would be congested, you'd have a very different price outcome. I just was a little confused by this example.
So if you go back to the previous slide, we said the maximum you can reduce G is 200. So we purposely tried to make a very simplified example so that we don't introduce congestion into this example.
So that's the maximum you can reduce the ISO generation?
Right. Right. That way we can show that G1 stays marginal because that's where we can get the extra megawatt. So again, these are very simplified examples just to make the point that I'm trying to get to here.
All right. Thank you.
So we do see that California load is being served by getting 200 megawatts from somebody. The question is it G1 or G3? And G3 is the only one that incremented. So you could think, well, that makes pretty straightforward. It's G3s whose emissions should have been is really the atmospheric effect caused by California. So now let's solve this independently. And you can see we've started to introduce this two-pass solution. If we solve this independently without California, you can see that G1 and G3, well, of course you would dispatch G3 up to its maximum because it's lower cost to serve the overall PacWest, PacEast, and Nevada energy than G1, which can be dispatched down. Okay, so yeah, there is no carbon program externally. So you know, $30 energy is cheaper than $35 energy, and you get the optimal dispatch outside of California. All right. So now, if you use the solution from the previous starting point as the point to measure who is supporting that incremental transfer to California, you can now see that it's really G1. So it is appropriate to attribute the GHG compliance obligation to G1 because this is the resource that was actually incremented from an appropriate base, recognizing that there is economic optimization, that those base schedules outside of California have not been optimized. But once you optimize them, then you can discover what is the actual resource that was incremented and better align the attribution than what the current methodology does. So it is appropriate, even though when we look at this slide, slide 10, that the only resource that went up is G3, it is appropriate to actually attribute the GHG obligation to G1. And that was the point I was trying to make earlier, is that you can't simply look at the base schedules and because they're not optimized, things that can look like a backfill effect are actually not a backfill effect because you need to do that first pass to determine whether or not it was. So in coming up with a solution, you need to make sure that you capture the correct incremental dispatch when determining who to attribute the obligations. So, again, the current base schedules, those are used for settlement purposes. They're not optimal. The individual EIM entities' balancing authority areas don't optimize them. They definitely don't optimize them across each other balancing authority areas. And this redispatch can occur for economics, congestion, completely independent of why there's a transfer to California. So as we showed in this example, since we dispatched G1 down, it is appropriate that it could be incrementally dispatched to then serve California. And you don't see this today because we co-optimize the entire footprint, and we don't put some other baseline by which to measure the and to enforce that the attribution has to come from some incrementally dispatched resource. And then lastly, this is why we need to come up with a different a two-path solution, because again, that base schedule is not a good reference to determine the atmospheric effect. Ellen.
Hi, Ellen Wolf for WPTF. I have a question, and I am not clear when the right time to ask it is, but it's not clear to me what the reference case should represent. And I think in your examples, you have it representing the case where outside of California is fully optimized and inside of California is fully optimized, but there are no trades. But that to me is not real intuitive, given that there are trades in the bilateral world and there are trades in the day-ahead market. So going back to a pure zero trade representation as the base case is not entirely intuitive. And I don't know if that gets queued up as a quality of this design that we discussed or what your thinking is on that.
So the base case, and George, you can jump in too. The base case, what we're for the first pass, we're not allowing transfers into California. That's the only thing we're restricting. Because it's only, and then we redispatch the entire system, and then you've got a starting point to say, okay, now let's allow, in the second pass, incremental dispatches, or allow a transfer into California, and enforce the attribution to be above that previous determined GHG allocation base that we were calling.
All right, so if I may follow up, and again, you can push this off to the latter part of the discussion, because I know you queue up this concept more there. How would you, for example, rationalize the fact that if you're applying this method for the EIM in the real time, in the day-ahead market, there have been some, say, imports into California that have paid a GHG
yep.
burden and so forth. It seems then, how do you rationalize those two? The fact that there are transfers that will have occurred prior to the time you run this market, even though you're presuming that there are no transfers.
Let me answer this. Okay, so imports and exports to California at the ISO scheduling points, they're not part of the transfers, right? The transfers is energy that is exchanged between the balancing authority areas and the EIM area. And those do not include what you have today in the day-ahead market as imports and exports at scheduling points. You can have bilateral contracts between BAAs in the EIM area, which are represented in what we call the base transfer, which is scheduled before the market runs. But the base transfers with the ISO are zero because they have to first clear the market. And if there are any artifacts from the day-ahead market, then what we do is in real time we mirror them at mirror resources. They're not part of the transfer. So that's why when you saw this in the first pass, all these bilaterals are already in place. So what we don't want to allow is the dynamic exchange of energy between the EIM balancing authority areas and the ISO balancing authority area. So any other bilaterals are already in place. You already have those in the solution. You don't exclude them.
All right, thank you. Can I just repeat back what I think I understood, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. So with respect to bilaterals that may have been scheduled through an EIM BAA, you reflect those in the base schedule, essentially. They're part of the base schedule.
Yeah, correct.
And then with respect to imports through non-EI MBAA scheduling points, you will represent them in the base case also by emulating them in some way?
Yeah, so when you solve the first pass solution, all these import and export bits for at the ISO scheduling points, they're part of the solution. But you have a constraint that says we don't want to have energy transfers into California. But those energy transfers are separate from those imports and exports to ISO at the ISO scheduling points. There's no conflict.
Great. So then that means to me that you are sort of trying to get the day-ahead position represented in your first pass.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to the phone.
Lauren, we'll take the question. Thank you.
Hi, this is Wajo from SC. I just want to understand better from the last conversation. So when you talk about energy transfer into the CAISO, so you're really talking about the EIM energy transfer, because even you say it's, you have day-ahead import-export being transferred to the ISO, but you won't make that to be zero. Am I right, or...?
Yes, you're correct. I'm just going to correct the fact that you refer to that as a transfer. So imports and exports to ISO at ISO scheduling points, they're not related. They're different than EIM transfers, okay? So that's why these are still in the solution. What we restrict in the first pass solution is the EIM transfer into the ISO, and that does not include those import and export bits to the ISO at ISO scheduling points.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, question in the room.
Kevin Woodruff, and on the slide 13, again, the bottom bullet, you talk about the current EIM base schedule. You mean the base schedule submitted to the EIM, okay. Okay, it's not like a new, okay, great. And then the wording of the second bullet, say if a resource would have been dispatched down economically outside the Cal ISO, it shouldn't be a secondary dispatch when then used to meet ISO load. It seems like that would be more like a primary dispatch if you're, you know.
Well, again, I was. If you think of the example we just walked through, the secondary, you know, we do this all simultaneously. So
right.
We're using the term secondary dispatch just to help explain it a little better.
Right.
But what we walked through the example here is, there was a secondary dispatch that occurred that was G1, G3 serving G1. It just happened that actually gave us headroom to then allocate it to G1, which means we actually appropriately calculated it. But had we never if you'd sort of changed the prices around to where G1 would have never been back down economically, then we did pick the wrong one to attribute the GHG to.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, so we walked through these, and so we've been looking at three options to consider to address for this secondary dispatch. So the first one was to calculate the overall GHG impact based upon some counterfactuals, and over a period of time, determine whether or not, you know, because we highlighted there's some instances where the ISO is transferring out non-emitting resource, which decreases the emitting resources outside of California, and there are instances where, yes, the attribution went to a non-emitting resource, but probably should have gone to an emitting resource, and we would look over a period of time and see was the total impact over time to the atmosphere, did it increase the amount of carbon or decrease the amount of carbon? And if it increased the amount of carbon, then we would identify the amount of compliance instruments that needed to be surrendered to account for that, and in the event that there was an overall reduction in carbon because the transfers out of clean resources from California exceeded the incremental dispatches of emitting resources, there wouldn't be a credit or anything. And this one does bring into a sort of an intertemporal approach currently isn't well aligned with CARB regulations. The next one is what we called option two, and this is where you modify the optimization, you maintain that resource-specific cost and resource-specific attribution, but you do the two-path solution so that you can identify correctly the resource that was truly incremented to serve California load, and do that all through the ISO's market optimization. You know, this does add another pass to the real-time market, so there are some computational concerns with that. And then the last option was we modify the optimization. We try to keep the best possible way, as much as possible, the resource-specific cost attribution, but we recognize that we may, in some instances, miss some of the emissions. And so we develop a residual emissions rate that we apply to all transfers to California to try to cover that, the fact that we missed some. You would come up with this residual rate through some study, and again, it's an approximation, but this is more straightforward in terms of an implementation standpoint. So we walked through these all in detail, gave examples, and then took comments on these from stakeholders. I'm going to go one more slide, okay. And so at the workshop, we stated that option one may be inconsistent with the ARB regulatory framework, that option two was the best long-term solution, but it's not something that we could implement consistent with the 2018 reporting period for CARB. And we could implement option three, but it wasn't an optimal long-term solution. You lose some of the price and dispatch signals you want to give to clean resources relative to emitting resources. So with that, I'll stop and take any questions in the room. Go ahead.
Hi, Brian Bering with Ellison, Schneider & Harris. Just a question on the timing for option three. So it sounds like you guys are still thinking about kind of a near-term solution and a longer-term solution. And I guess the question on option three is, you know, with the current rulemaking cycle for the cap and trade going into 2017, and then, you know, the process I would assume you need to go through with FERC, could you apply that to the 2017 transactions in 2017?
So from a bridge standpoint, so I mean, we want to move based on stakeholder comments, and I think I might have missed a slide or moved it. So, you know, stakeholder comments said we don't like option three at all, and we think option two is the best long-term solution. And so I think our position is we're going to focus on developing option two. And we're going to focus our development and technical experts on coming up with a feasible way to do that as soon as possible. It is not going to occur in 2017. We don't have a specific date because, again, a lot of this we'll see from the simplifications that we want to make. It's you know, we need to have some ability to review and see if we've got the performance that we need to move forward. Given that the real-time dispatch is how we actually run the grid, and so we're adding accounting, GHG accounting functionality in a second pass, and so it's not going to be ready for the 2018 compliance period. So there is a need for some bridge through there. That bridge cannot be through an ISO market optimization. That would then require us to take resources and develop this intermediate step when everyone wanted us to. Didn't like even as an intermediary measure option three, so something would need to be done, maybe consistent with option one, but it's done outside the ISO market optimization, so that we can focus on getting option two as soon as possible. Yep.
Lauren, we'll take the question in the queue.
Hi, this is Ayat Osman again from OIR. I'm sorry to go back, but on slide 11, on the base case, I'm just trying to understand this better. G3, the way you presented here without ISO, has it been dispatched or not?
In this scenario, it's economic to increase G3's output and reduce G1's output because $30 from G3 is cheaper than $35 from G1.
So G3 has been dispatched regardless of California load.
That's correct. That's the point.
So the atmospheric effect already happened regardless of California.
No. Look, you can't expect that it's happened before California because they have not. There's been no optimization between PAC West, PAC East, and Nevada. That hasn't happened yet. They've just submitted their own independent base schedules, and we haven't determined what the optimal dispatch is across that entire footprint.
Okay. So when you optimize now. G3 from slide 12. Can you explain what happens with G3 again, please?
So let's be clear. In slide 11, this is the result of an optimization that has done a least cost optimization across PacWest, PacEast, and Nevada. Slide 12, I've now added the California ISO into the mix and re-optimized. And G1 at $35 plus a zero GHG cost, you can see is cheaper than generation in the ISO, which is set at $40. So you increment up G1 to serve California load.
And G3 is not in the picture in this solution?
Well, again, G3 is in the optimization. And its dispatch stays at 200, which it was in the previous step.
So my point is that the atmospheric effect has happened in both base case and in the optimization, regardless of California. And I'm just, I don't know how to explain this better, but I like the tip that you use attributing the incremental effect to serve California load than using the word atmospheric effect, because atmospheric effect would have happened anyways regardless of California's load. Your G3 has already been dispatched, and correct me if I'm wrong, right? Slide 11 and slide 12, in both cases, G3 has already been dispatched.
That's correct. You're making the point I'm trying to make, in that the emissions are that from G3 are not the result of California load.
So that's contrary to my understanding at the beginning, because I asked this question and I got the response that this incremental would not have happened absent California load.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make, is the fact that G3 from the starting point is the only resource that was dispatched up from its base schedule, you can't automatically say that's because of California. It's not as simple as that. And so that's the point of why you actually need two passes. Because you don't want to, it's just way too simple of an assumption. You're going to overstate what the actual emissions were as a result of California load.
The point I'm trying to make, I think I agree with you, but the point that I'm trying to make is not use the term atmospheric effect, because atmospheric effect would have happened anyways, because it's a global effect. What ARB is trying to do is attribute the emissions to a certain resource. And the better term to use is the incremental.
Hi, this is Andrew Ulmer with the California ISO. Not to interrupt you, but I mean, I think what our market challenge is to make sure that we somehow figured out a means to align with ARB's regulations so that we can identify the greenhouse gas emission intensity associated with an EIM transfer. So maybe atmospheric effects is not the perfect parlance, but it's a proxy for that GHG intensity that we're trying to capture.
And I think
it gives a wrong message to anyone that reads this. From scientific point of view, it doesn't make sense. Atmospheric effect happens anyways, and it's a global effect. So
I think for the purpose of this discussion, we can consider the term atmospheric effect as being the atmospheric effect attributable to California load, subject to ARB regulation. I think this is the context that we are using this term here. So in that context, I don't think you disagree, correct?
Correct. Although I wouldn't use the word atmospheric effect, and I would rather have the attributed or incremental effect to serve California load or attributed to California load.
Fine.
I'm sorry about that. Sorry to be picky.
Okay, Lauren, we'll go ahead and take the next question.
Hi, this is Ezra Heilsman on behalf of Sierra Club again. Actually, my question also relates to slide 12. Right, sorry to keep making you go backward. But I think it's an important point, and this is going to show up in a number of the examples as well. If you look at the way you've calculated the price here, the $35 price makes sense as an incremental price to serve California load. But the decremental price in this case would actually, like if you know, had a megawatt of energy efficiency in California, it would cause G3 to ramp down because from a California perspective, that would be the highest cost resource that's meeting load, including that GHG cost. So it seems like we have two effects of that. First of all, that there's some ambiguity about what the LNP is, because, and then the second bizarre thing is that you have a case where the decremental price is actually higher than the incremental price. This is a number of the examples, and it's hard to know whether it's just an effect of the simplified example or sort of a fundamental shortcoming of trying to do this, the accounting with this approach.
This is George from the ESO. George Angelides, I think you're pointing out that we may have a situation where the solutions are somewhat degenerate because of the simplicity and the fact that we don't have losses, and that might be true in some of the cases. So you're pointing out that the price is not uniform for incrementing and decrementing load. Am I correct? Is this your observation?
Well, that is a general observation that, in examples, it's helpful if it is somehow set up so you have the same price for incrementing and decrementing. But it also goes to, I think, a deeper point, which is that by calculating or doing this attribution only on the basis of what you increment, to understand the rationale for that, given CARB's requirement to attribute greenhouse gases to meeting California load. But if you were to reduce load in California, you would come up with a different answer in terms of what generator is responding to that. So, you get back to what is the atmospheric impact, with apologies to the previous questioner, but the atmospheric impact kind of depends on whether you're looking at it from an incremental or decremental perspective, as does the price. And I think that's going to be a serious obstacle going forward.
No, I think I will acknowledge the fact that in the simple examples where we have the generation center constraints and you finish, you find the optimal solution at the point where the generator hits its limit, you may have some degeneracy in the results, and you have this, in some of the examples you have a phenomenon where, your LMP is different for 1 megawatt of additional load as opposed to reducing the load. And that is a degeneracy that you see sometimes in the simple solutions. This is not a problem in the real world when we have losses that make the problem nonlinear, and we always have a clear price unless there are certain, you know, very rare scenarios. So if we go past this, because, you know, we wanted to show you simple examples to understand the methodology, we realize here that, you know, the pricing may be degenerate on the simple examples, but we really want to go past this issue to understand how these algorithms and these methodologies work. So in that respect, if you allow us to use the simple examples to illustrate the concept, and when we go through the spreadsheet, we'll spend some more time on this issue, if you don't mind.
Thank you.
Lauren will take the next question.
Hi, Dylan. This is Margaret Miller with Customized Energy Solutions.
Hey, Margaret.
I have an easier question. I'm happy to see that the ISO is focusing on the longer-term solution, but I was interested to understand a little bit better what you see the path forward is for the bridge solution. Will the CAISO continue to work closely with CARB on that bridge solution, but it will take place entirely within CARB's rulemaking process going forward? And considering the magnitude of the problem, do you see that maybe do nothing in the short term is still on the table?
I would say from a bridge standpoint, everything's on the table. I think the point I was trying to make is that we don't, you know, the goal was to prioritize resources on option two to get that as soon as possible, because even option three in the interim didn't have a lot of support. We don't want to then come up with some other solution that we have to then change the market optimization and spend time on that. Now, with regards to doing some bridge strategy, I don't think that fully takes the ISO off the hook. I think we may need to, we'll continue to work with CARB on how to do that. We may need to provide some information to help them in whatever bridge strategy they develop.
Thanks, Don.
Okay, Lauren, we'll take the next question.
Hi, Don. Dan Williams from Portland General. And just a quick question to hopefully clarify my understanding. So non-participating resources would generally be considered to be serving the local load that they're associated with, and any generator imbalance that they might have that could cause some redispatch of other units in EIM to cover for their movement would get picked up in the course of what you were explaining in the last couple slides. Is that a correct way of looking at it? Or
So a non-participating resource cannot receive an attribution and through the market, and a participating resource that has a 0 megawatt GHG bid also can't be considered for transfers to California. So all you're pointing out is that non-participating resources and participating resources without GHG bids, as well as any load changes, those are simply not available to support transfers.
Okay, good. That was
so it reduces the pool of resources that can result in a transfer to California.
Great. Thanks.
Ellen?
Hi, Ellen Wolfer, WPTF. I just wanted to follow up on that. I'm not sure I understood your answer. If I did, it seems like it has some strong implications. Did you say that a resource that has a 0 GHG bid, dollar per megawatt bid, are you saying?
Or the megawatt.
Oh, quantity. Okay.
That's all how right. They opt out of.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry, I have one quick follow-up on that. So if you do have a resource that is zero, you know, so Seattle City Light has hydro resources, but if we wanted to bid in California, how should we treat that? Is there guidance for how to be transferred into be available for transfer into California, but you actually have a zero?
On an hourly basis, you submit a megawatt quantity, so that's how much of your output of your plant you're willing to have serve California, and you put in a price. Now, the price that you put in is cost-based, so we calculate a daily maximum price. Well, in the instance of hydro, the daily maximum price would be zero because it's non-emitting, and so you simply submit a megawatt quantity, and the price you would submit, bid price you would submit, would be zero.
And it would, so even if that price is zero, it's available for transfer to California?
Well, that's the bid that you've submitted. Now, when we optimize, if a non-emitting resource is the marginal resource attributed to California, then of course the price to serve transfers into California would be zero. But if, for instance, natural gas was the marginal resource serving the transfer to California, that price for GHG would be $5. So you would be awarded a megawatt quantity, and you would be paid the $5 if gas is on the market.
Okay, so sorry, I'm kind of slow on this. I think the question that we've had internally is just what we should include in our bid.
All right. Make it very simple. You put the greenhouse gas megawatt at the Pmax of the resource, and the greenhouse gas bid price at $0 per megawatt hour. That will maximize the potential attribution for imports into California.
Okay.
And just, this is Andrew Ulmer with the California ISO. Generally, we don't provide much in the way of guidance to market participants and how they should construct bids. But what Don's describing is the aspect of how we manage our greenhouse gas bid adders. Obviously, resources can put in energy bids, and they can be, obviously, we expect them to be non-zero in most cases, but sometimes they're negative. But in terms of a GHG bid adder, we've structured the market rules now so that it's a cost-based bid adder. So the extent of your resource is going to experience GHG compliance costs, you should be bidding consistent with that. And that's pretty well documented. We can certainly provide the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission orders and tariff rules on that. And that, I think, probably will provide sufficient guidance for a market participant or a prospective market participant about how to structure a GHG bid adder for any particular resource.
Okay. Well, I will assume that the offline conversations will be helpful for my people. Thanks.
Okay. We're good to move forward. Okay, so in determining which option to pick, we tried to think of some principles that we should pursue to sort of ground our decision-making, and I'll walk through those. The first was to ensure that we track the emissions impacting the atmosphere as a result of generation outside of California that's dispatched by the ISO market to serve California. So those, we want to accurately account for that. And we want those emissions to be consistent and reflected in ARB's regulations. So we want to make sure that the market results align with the CARB's GHG regulations. Next, we want to make sure that any supplier that's selling power to California load has the ability to recover their costs to comply with the ARB greenhouse gas approach regulations. So this ensures that, that's why we allow that cost-based bid on that separate GHG bid adder. We also want to mitigate the impact of the ISO's market's GHG tracking mechanisms on market ISO market prices for electricity to serve load outside of California. This is, since there's not a GHG program in outside of California, we don't want the cost of complying with that to impact the LMPs externally when that external load is being served by external generation. We want to make sure that the solution is scalable to a regional balancing authority area and can be included in the day-ahead market, which this can. We want the resources located outside of California to continue to be able to opt out. That's the ability to bid 0 megawatts of any EIM transfer or any regional transfer in a multi-state balancing authority area. Next, we wanted resources that are not attributed to supporting California load, that they're not required to make any CARB compliance obligations, surrender any instruments, for example. And then lastly, we want the regional and EIM transfers serving California load to have similar regulatory requirements as other supply. Such that this is why, you know, doing the resource-specific emissions rate is so important. You know, this is why we highlighted that the hurdle rate of doing the residual emissions rate was simple. It would violate this principle. And then lastly, we want to consider the ability to how this approach would work with other GHG regulatory programs that may be developed in the future, and we'll talk about how that does, how that can be later in the afternoon. So I'll pause here and see if there was, and again, we're happy to take any other comments that people might have in their written comments on the principles, and if anyone has any comments or questions on these. All right.
Thanks. Angela Tangetti with the California Energy Commission. We seem to be using the term California load and ISO interchangeably. It's the California ISO load, correct?
Well, I think you're getting to one of the paradigm changes that I talked about that we need to make, is that you can't make the assumption that California ISO is California load. That's why we're sort of saying California supply, and it's hard for me to even catch myself every time using them interchangeably, but it is an important distinction that with this approach, you need to think of it as California supply serving California load, especially in the first pass. But I'll get to that. Okay. So, go ahead.
Good morning. Nora Scherer for CLECA. I just noticed the last line that you have on this slide. My eyes are not as good as they used to be. Slide 18, where you reference the state implementation plans under the Clean Power Plan.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any general sense that your expectations there may have changed over the past couple of weeks?
I think what we're saying is we wanted to make sure that this approach is scalable regardless of who won the presidential election. So I think that what we've come up with is so that that it would actually support whether you probably multiple different approaches to how people would want to do it independent of what federal direction is. Paul.
Paul Gribick, PG&E. I know this seems to have changed a bit from the original discussion of leakage, in that originally, if I was bringing in power from a clean resource, which would have been used outside of California, and I backfill it with an emitting resource, that was considered leakage. And even if that resource did not allow its energy to be imported into California for attribution of GHG costs, CARB wanted to capture the GHG costs, and we were talking about assigning that to someone, whether it was California load or a third party or whatever. This, now you're saying you're not going to do that. So it's not, I would say you're not trying to capture leakage here, you're trying to prevent leakage. You're saying, I can't, you know, whoever is imported, there is no leakage, I'm going to assign it to them.
That's a good point. We are trying to better align the attribution to that resource that was truly dispatched to serve California, minimizing this sort of backfill effect.
Well, I think you'd eliminate it here.
Yeah.
I guess one of the things I'd like to have considered is, I don't know the amount of resources you get that allow themselves to be imported into California that would not be dispatched outside of California. If that turns out to be relatively small, I'm wondering what effect this would have on the benefits of the EIM and the efficiency of the dispatch. The allowing resources that would not allow their energy to be attributed for import to be dispatched for backfill, capturing the GHG costs and assigning it to someone may lead to a more efficient solution. I'm just concerned that you might want to do a little study of that to make sure that we're not really losing a lot of the benefits of EIM if we get too stringent on this. That's just
okay.
A comment.
Paul, it's a good comment, and as we can see from the examples that we're going to go later on, you will see that with the two-pass approach, in certain scenarios, the transfer to California is reduced as opposed to the status quo with the approach that we're using today. So if someone is strictly calculating the benefit based on the transfer, you can say that the benefits could be reduced. If you include in the benefit calculations, though, the responsibility for greenhouse gas obligations, then the story may be a little different, because what the two-pass approach tries to do is to make sure that we don't give attribution to resource dispatch outside of California that would have been used anyway based on the assumption that we have for the greenhouse gas base to serve load outside of California. So if we take that into consideration, the whole discussion of what is the benefit of EIM takes a little different angle, and I think we should do that because we actually have a solution that tries to balance both these objectives.
Yeah. No, I have no problem with the two-pass solution. I think that's probably a decent way to go. All I'm concerned about is should we just require any incremental dispatch to be from resources that allow themselves to be attributed for import, or would we get more efficiency if we said, look, we'll have a third party that says, I will take on their greenhouse gas obligations for any resources that are incremented to backfill, and I will be the person. I'm just wondering if we get more efficiency. That's all I'm looking at.
And I think we'd even talked about that in the original, or back in EIM year one, phase two, when we put in the ability to bid 0 megawatts, because you could see that if everyone bids 0 megawatts, we've significantly decreased the benefits. And so that was something we were going to keep watching, and we haven't found that to be the case yet. Okay. So with that, I'll sort of describe again the two-path solution. So what we want to do now is to get an appropriate starting point to measure whether the resource is incrementally dispatched to serve the transfer into the ISO. And so that's what we're calling this GHG allocation base. Again, we cannot use the base schedules that are submitted because they're really just used for inbound settlement. That's their only purpose. So to do this, to come up with the GHG allocation base, we have to have a two-step process. The first is we optimize all of the schedules outside of California without allowing transfers into California, and this will determine the GHG allocation base for any resource outside of California. And this allows that redispatch to occur that would have happened economically outside of California. The second step, we then run the optimization again. This time we do allow transfers to California, and the attribution can only occur to resources above that GHG allocation base determined in the first step. So this way you've allowed the economic optimization to occur externally, and now we are able to isolate which resource was truly incremented. Question in the back.
Hey, John Hughes, NV Energy. In your straw proposal, you mentioned that if the GHG allocation is lower than the one in the previous market, you'll buy back, or that participant will buy back the difference. Is that constraint shadow price going to differ between FMM and RTD?
It can differ, yes.
It can be, mm-hmm. Even though the bid prices don't change.
Correct, because the marginal price changed.
Okay.
Yep.
Lauren will take the question on the phone.
Hi, this is Bonnie Blair. I represent the six cities. I apologize if you covered this before, but in step one, do you allow transfers out of California?
Yes, you do.
Okay, thank you.
Christine Kirsten from PacifiCorp.
I'm still a little confused about George's answer to Ellen earlier about the imports and exports. So you're doing this path without transfers to California. Is that defined as EIM transfers?
Correct.
Are transfers different than imports?
When we use transfers, they're completely different than imports and exports. Transfers are only occur in the energy imbalance market between the balancing authority areas.
Okay, okay. I just thought maybe for simplicity, you might want to just define that further.
We have actually defined the concept of the transfer as energy exchange dynamically between BAAs in the EIM area. Now, with the paradigm shift that Don mentioned, that we can consider the ISO control area as the California for load or supply purposes, we'll have to also distinguish what we call today as a transfer between control areas with what is the relevance here of calling transfer as energy coming to California load, or to serve California load. So that's, I would like to differentiate the terms now for future sake, that today when we call EIM transfers is dynamic energy exchange between control areas, which we'll still have, all right? And then here, when we're talking about transfer attribution to serve California load, that is slightly different because that is between greenhouse gas regulation areas, an area that has a greenhouse gas regulation and an area that doesn't have greenhouse gas regulation. Because in the future, those will not align exactly with control area. So we have to start distinguishing these terms. So it's a very good question. It gives me the opportunity to highlight that.
Ellen.
Hi, Ellen Wolf. I wanted to follow up on Christine's follow-up to my original question. Just, you know, really clarify something you just said. So does that mean for this solution in the EIM, you would plan to implement new constraints for non-California load in the CAISO BAA?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Say that one more time. Sorry, Angela Tang.
Yes.
My question was whether for this EIM implementation, would the ISO plan to create a new constraint that distinguishes the non-California load that currently exists or could exist in the future in the California ISO BAA.
Right. We'll get to that, but we're going to get to that in a few slides. But yes, you're going to basically have a constraint between what we're calling like greenhouse gas regimes. You've got one that's got a certain one state that's got a certain program. You might have a combination of states that have another program, and you might have ones that have no program at all. And so you're going to have various regimes, and you're going to not allow transfers between certain regimes in the first pass. And that's what takes the EIM solution into the regional solution. And it basically makes them the same. I'll go to the phone.
So Lauren, it looks like we have a couple questions in the queue.
Hi, this is Wade from SC. Sorry to ask more questions about the energy transfers in the day ahead or this new paradigm.
Okay.
But I'm more confused after hearing some responses here. In the day ahead market, what transfer exactly is going to be reduced to zero in the first pass round?
To get a little bit more understanding on your question, are you referring in the day-ahead market as it's going to take shape after, let's say, Pacifico joins the ISO control area? Or are you referring to the status quo?
No, not day-ahead market as of today. It would be the day-ahead market when a new entity joins the day-ahead market. I think because your solution is not only for EIM, but also for the regional expansion. So.
Right.
The question is, after the region expansion, what exactly the transfer on the intertie between the California GHG regime and other non-GHG regime, what the transfer there will be reduced to zero?
Yes, under this two-pass proposal, in the first pass, we don't allow the area that doesn't have greenhouse gas regulation to export energy into the area or areas that have a greenhouse gas regulation.
Okay, so that's much more restrictive than in the EIM, but because in the Bay-Ham market,
it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. In the EIM, you have exactly the same situation, but now in EIM, you have additional transfers. These are the transfers that we have today between control areas. Those are not affected. They're different constraints. I mean, there's a secondary effect, but when you solve the first pass, you still have the same constraint, both in the day ahead and in real time. You have non-regulation areas. They may be different in the footprint, but you do have them. And you have greenhouse gas regulation areas or area in the day ahead. And you have the same constraint that will prevent or prohibit energy exports from the areas that they don't have a greenhouse gas regulation to areas that have a greenhouse gas regulation. It's the same constraint. The footprint may be different, but it's the same constraint.
Okay, so I think if I can understand what you just said, so in EIM, the transfer, EIM transfer, which you have today, would be reduced to zero.
No, I didn't say that. Okay, I'm making a distinction from what we call today EIM transfer, which is energy dynamically exchanged between control areas, and what we really refer to here, which is greenhouse gas transfer, if I can use this term, which is energy exchange between an area that doesn't have greenhouse gas regulation and area or areas that have a greenhouse gas regulation. So these are two different constraints, and I'm trying to differentiate them.
And I think it'd be helpful for us to wait till slide 24 to get into that, because we give an example and explain why you need to actually make this shift. And I think once you understand why you have to do it, it becomes more intuitive about what it really is.
Okay, thanks. I will wait to that time, but I think my basic point is whether this is going to create a same issue between the day and the real time for the first pass round. But I will wait. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep. All right, Lauren, we'll take the last question.
Hello, this is Ayaz Osman again from ORA. Can you clarify
You're cutting out. We're not able to hear your question.
And the transfer.
Can you repeat your question, please?
Maybe to clarify in your explanation between or differentiate between transfers into California and the import and export when from outside California dispatched to serve load in California.
So you could have an import from a balancing authority area that's not in the EIM footprint that serves California load. So that would be an import serving California load. And I'm speaking purely in the real-time market. And in the real-time market, you could also have an EIM transfer, which represents participating resources within the EIM footprint that are serving load in California.
Right. So building on that, there is no constraint on the first one, on the import to California in the first pass. There is a constraint on the second one, on the EIM transfer. To serve California load in the first pass. We don't allow the import to California on the EIM transfers. But regular import-export bids at ISO scheduling points, they're not restricted.
So I lied. There is one more question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Paul Nelson with Southern California Edison.
Hey, Paul, can you speak up just a little bit?
Sorry, is that better?
A little better.
How about now?
I can hear you okay now.
Okay, sorry about that. I have a question kind of related to the regime change. I just was going to get kind of explicit here. So Valley Electric, which is located in Nevada, I mean, currently that's considered to be sort of California load and gets attributed to GHG cost.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also embedded in the – because their LMPs are treated just like they were located in California.
That's correct.
But you're talking about the regime change, that would change. They would no longer be treated like they were physically located in California. And their LMPs,
as you,
how it construct, would probably change. Is that correct?
It's as you move to this paradigm where you are where you're looking at the transfers between greenhouse gas regulation regimes, that is correct.
And so the Pacificorp portion in Northern California, I think currently is sort of considered to be outside of California, would then now be considered to be in California.
And once there was the combined Pacificorp became a PTO, absolutely. So as you'll see later on in the slides, what it comes down to is that when you're setting up load aggregation points, generation aggregation points and stuff, those must be aligned with the various GHG regimes as well.
So we're talking about the regime change. We're only talking about under a regional expansion scenario where Pacificorp joins the balancing authority. If that doesn't happen, we're then talking their sort of existing regime. Is that correct?
No, I'm saying that the concept of moving from a BAA level to a GHG regulation area or regime,
okay,
that is also needed to support the EIM solution in real time.
Okay. So then the LMP construct for Pacificorp's Northern California customers, those LMPs would change.
Potentially. I'd have to think through a little bit and take that one back.
I mean, because essentially right now their LMPs exclude the cost of GHG because you have that fourth component.
That's correct.
Which is the subtraction off the energy price. But tomorrow what you're saying is those LMPs then would have to include the GHG price into it.
In all honesty, I've thought through the Valley Electric one, the Pacificorp Northern California one. I haven't thought through is as much.
Right. And then I'm looking at my map here, and I also see this may or may not apply to NV Energy because I'm looking at their little footprint, and I see what was the old Sierra Pacific Power. I see this little peak point around Lake Tahoe. So you've got – I'm not sure what's happening with that piece with Nevada Energy of where their
future. As a customer of Tahoe Donner Utility District, I'll spell – special attention to make sure that's correct.
And I won't go to fringe load and I won't even address that because I think that's entirely another subject matter that's even more in the weeds of this one. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. There's a question in the room.
Hi, Kevin Woodruff. I'm going to ask you maybe to take a step back. This is something, don't go back there, but something I first noticed on slide 11 where you say you take the EIM entities, the non-California EIM entities, and optimize their schedules. And I see that's your proposed step one here as well. The overall impact of the EIM is the three separate control arrays submit their base schedules. And then you take step one here and you optimize those base schedules to something that's sort of a, and then you take step two and plug California into the mix. Okay.
Right.
And there's an argument to be made. I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just trying to sort of paint the big picture here about the impact of the EIM overall, and then we can get to what you need to do here to satisfy ARB. But it seems like the overall impact of the EIM on cost and GHGs is really in reference to the base schedules. That's sort of that would be a starting point for, wouldn't that be a starting point?
No, I think that's the issue is you can't use those base schedules because again, you could have impacts where you're changing, you're restricting the economic dispatch that would have occurred externally. So it really is why you can't start with the base schedules, because again, this is really just for settlement purposes and haven't been optimized. They haven't been optimized within a BAA. They haven't been optimized across the non-California BAAs. So that's why we have to do that first pass to get to a starting point to where we can ensure that we've addressed all of those basic economic trades have already occurred so that we can get the correct GHG allocation. So back to our G1 versus G3, so I know which one that I've got because I can do the increment off that GHG allocation base.
But so, Kevin, what we can say this way, that the base schedule is a reference for imbalance energy purposes, so for settlement purposes, but we cannot use that schedule as what we call the greenhouse gas base allocation reference. For that reference, we need to seek something different. That's what PASS 1 does.
But, I mean, if those base schedules reflect how the different balancing authorities would have operated their systems, you know, plan to operate their systems, then...
I think that's the assumption that's wrong.
Okay.
That's not how they're planning to operate their system.
Okay.
But the way they're going to operate their system is the results of the market optimization.
Well, but if they weren't members of the EIM, do the base schedules represent what they would do absent the EIM, or do you know that?
I think, remember, base schedules are an hourly granularity, too, so I don't know
right.
how they're going to do it on a five-minute basis or intra-hour, too, and that's what EIM gives you.
Okay, it still seems there's an optimization step that's happening in the EIM that wouldn't be happening if the EIM weren't there, that happens before step one.
I think you're correct that another benefit of the EIM is that there is this feedback loop
right.
that you would expect over time that EIM entities would get better at submitting base schedules because they know what those mean from a congestion standpoint, and so that they become more accurate to what actually is going to happen. But again, that's just a feedback loop. But there's still no assumption that it's absolutely correct, especially across all the balancing authority areas.
Okay, I'll need to think about this some more. Thank you.
Okay, so moving forward. So a couple other notes. Again, we already talked about this a little bit earlier, is that the real-time market dispatch is really what we use to operate the grid. So we have to solve this optimization problem within 5 minutes. And we're looking to now solve it twice to add some of the greenhouse gas functionality. And what this requires is, what can we do to find a more simplified way to determine that starting point to measure the GHG allocation so that we can actually come up with that quicker? Now, while this approach is significantly improved over the current methodology in terms of making sure you pick the right attribute to the right resource, there could still be some inaccuracies that result. But you know, that's where we cannot allow ourselves to let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. I think we're making, from addressing CARB's concerns with regards to the correct attribution, significant improvements in that area. And the fact that we have to make simplifying assumptions or simplify the first pass, which introduces a little bit of imprecision in that accounting, we shouldn't let that stop us from making this type of an enhancement. Okay. Question in the back.
John Hughes, NV Energy. Also in the straw proposal, when you've mentioned, you know, since the FMM is initialized from the last RTD run, RTD is initialized from the state estimator, it mentioned that there's maybe insufficient ramp capability to calculate a feasible solution in the first pass.
Mm-hmm.
So why is that? Why shouldn't FRP procure enough ramp to provide a feasible solution?
Because you may not have enough flexibility in the system online to cover the change from a hypothetical solution, which is the first pass, to a real solution, which is the second pass.
Yeah.
You see, from real solution to real solution, as time progresses, you should have enough flexibility, and we procure for that. But here we're talking about covering differences between a hypothetical solution and a real
yeah.
solution. The hypothetical solution says no transfers to California. If the previous solution had thousands of megawatts of transfer to California, you don't expect to have thousands of megawatts of flexibility in the system to cover that difference. That's not realistic.
But I think the key thing is, from second pass to second pass, it's completely consistent. The first pass, the second pass is not the issue. That's what we're trying to simplify. But from your concern in terms of are there settlement implications between the 15-minute market and the 5-minute market, that's second pass to second pass that determines that, which then ensures that everything's ramp feasible, all of that, because we aren't making any of those simplifying assumptions to get the second pass done. It's only the first pass.
Okay. Christine Kirsten from Pacific Core. I just wanted to clarify for that part of PAC-W that is in California, we are subject to the cap and trade program. Yep. In that area for imports. So, and Mary Winky can jump on if I said that incorrectly, but. Melissa, we'll go ahead and take the question in the queue.
This is Ezra Hausman once again, and I apologize if I'm fundamentally misunderstanding something, but my sense is that step one really is just a conceptual step or a calculation that's done for settlement purposes and doesn't actually affect the dispatch in step two. If that's the case, then I wonder why it's necessary to do that step one kind of in real time in these 5-minute intervals as opposed to doing it in parallel or even the next day if it's just for accounting purposes.
Yeah, it actually affects the dispatch because it provides the greenhouse gas base allocation reference, and then the allocation, the attribution of the energy that is imported to California is restricted to be only on incremental dispatch from that reference. So actually the way you calculate that reference can have material impact on the dispatch and of course the prices. And we will show that in the examples.
Okay. So moving forward, so again, stakeholders were pretty clear that option two was what they wanted us to focus on, so we are going to focus on option two. We need to note that it cannot be implemented in 2017 to support the ARB compliance year 2018. We are evaluating, and I'll get to some ways that we're doing it, how we can make that first pass as quick as possible when we determine that GHG allocation base for the resources outside of California. And we already talked about that there may be the need for a bridge solution until we can implement the two-pass solution. We have been looking at some approaches that we can use to minimize the solve time of the first pass. So the first is to avoid doing a full unit commitment, and we can avoid this by using results from a prior market run. We can also relax the ramping constraints that between the binding and the advisory intervals. Again, the binding interval is the only one used for settlement purposes, so using that as a way to get to we only really need the GHG allocation base from the binding interval for settlement purposes. We can then simplify the multi-interval optimization by not enforcing all of the network constraints in the later intervals. Again, this is only in phase one. All of this we would still maintain doing in pass two. And the next is to stagger the start of the first pass and the second pass such that you can be running the first pass earlier so that you can still hit your dispatch target timelines that are really from the second pass, which is really how we run the market. So again, we're looking through all of these as ways to minimize that solve time of the first pass, which allows us to then implement this into the real time. Ellen.
Hi, Ellen Wolf. Could you say a little bit more about your thoughts about relaxing network constraints? Because it seems like you could have a fundamentally different solution without network constraints than with network constraints.
Yes, that is correct, Ellen, but if you see the progression of the simplification steps here, without unit commitment, which is frozen to the previous solution, and without ramp constraints, which are, as I mentioned earlier, more of a necessity for the first pass because of the infeasibility that you will run into inevitably. So if you take those out, you already have a very simplified problem where each interval is isolated because you don't have the unit commuter, no intertemporal constraints to link the intervals. And then since our focus is the binding interval for which we have settlement, any kind of approximation that we can do for advisory intervals, it only has a tertiary effect on the outcome of the overall solution. And this is where the statement that Dan had in the previous slide, we don't want to have the perfect being the enemy of the good, comes into the picture, that we have major performance savings by not including the network for the advisory intervals. That means we don't have to run a power flow, we don't have to calculate shift factors, we don't have to calculate the active constraints. So without this, it becomes a rudimentary solution of merit order dispatch. But that's only for the advisory intervals. The advisory intervals will give you the advisory greenhouse gas base allocation for the advisory intervals, the advisory attribution, which doesn't get a settlement. We want to get the binding interval as much accurate as we can. For the advisory intervals, there is only secondary and tertiary effect. We can let that go.
Because we're going to calculate the accurate one the next time we run the first pass.
Again, this is only for the first pass. There's no approximation being proposed for the second pass. That's your real market solution. All the constraints are enforced there, okay?
Well, but the first pass is very relevant to the GHG attribution.
It is for the binding interval for which the GHG attribution is settled. What we're saying here is that doing it for the second interval, the third, the fourth, the 13th interval, because we're solving the whole time horizon, it really doesn't give you that much accuracy to justify the performance loss, particularly when we have to make this happen within the 5 minutes.
Okay, and I'm just trying to understand the basics here. So let's say somewhere in the WECC outside of California, you have a gen pocket of a lot of wind or a lot of solar or something. In the first pass, you're going to assume that all that can serve load outside of California, and you're going to tend to dispatch it up. If it was actually in a constrained area, then the actual pass may not have the same solution. Does that somehow influence the attribution in a way that is sort of has some qualities to it rather than just being a little bit of noise that's random in nature?
Okay. You're looking into California, that's even less important, right? Because what matters is what happens outside California. Because we want to calculate the greenhouse gas reference allocation for resources outside California.
Right, I'm thinking outside of California.
So it's more important to look at what happens outside California. Now, we don't have great activity today in terms of congestion management and enforced flow gate constraints external to PSO in the AAM, balancing authority areas. Even with the presence of that, you could have potentially a different greenhouse gas base allocation solution. Now, we don't do and we don't recommend that for the binding interval for which we're going to calculate binding results for. This is proposed for the advisory interval. So yes, the advisory greenhouse gas allocation may have a slightly inaccurate base. We don't settle that.
And we're going to rerun the
next time we're going to run the market, it's going to be the binding, and then we'll do it right. So that's the simplification that we offer. We have to sacrifice something to get this under 5 minutes, and this is probably the low-hanging fruit.
Okay, maybe I'm just misunderstanding. Make sure I get the language right. When you say advisory, is it the same thing as the first pass of your two passes?
No.
Oh.
The solution has many intervals. It's a multi-interval solution. All right, and in RTD, in our five-minute dispatch, the first solution is what we call the binding interval for which the results are financially binding. We settle those. The other intervals in the time horizon, up to 12 more intervals, we still calculate a solution. That is an advisory solution. There are reasons why we calculate a solution there, because we have intertemporal constraints, and we want to have the application have the ability to see what's coming because that may affect the dispatch for the binding interval, but really it's a secondary effect.
When
we say advisory, we mean all these other intervals in the time horizon for which there is no settlement, and they will be repeated, they will be resolved the next time the market runs,
okay,
the market window rolls, right?
Now that I understand my main misunderstanding, why do you calculate them at all? Why don't you just not calculate anything? Because all you need is one good first pass, your best first pass. The advisory first passes you're not going to use for anything, are you?
We still solve all intervals, so I need to do a greenhouse gas attribution for the advisory intervals as well. Otherwise, the problem will look very different for the advisory intervals. You will have an inconsistent solution that you minimize your greenhouse gas cost for the binding interval without looking at it at all for the advisory intervals. We want to have as high as possible quality solution for the binding interval. That's why we solve the advisories too. But when it comes to which base for the greenhouse gas allocation I'm going to use for the advisory intervals, this is where we propose to have some potential inaccuracy to have great performance savings.
Okay, so in the actual settlement interval you're going to enforce transmission constraints in the
yes.
first pass. Okay, so I get it. So the answer to my last question really was the same as the answer to Ezra's question. You need the first pass in the advisory intervals to try to get the second pass accurate, to try to set up the whole intertemporal solution to be as efficient as possible. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Melissa, we'll take the question on the phone.
Hi, good morning, Don. It's Mark Holman with PowerX.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, just a few comments. First, I wanted to say that, you know, we're strongly supportive of option two. We think you've done some great work here. We think it offers a lot of promise towards improving the dispatch and being more compliant with CARB's cap and trade program. So I think that's excellent. We recognize you need to make some simplifications. I think those are important in terms of which simplifications you do, and I think you've identified some good ones here in terms of, you know, how can you simplify while still getting a fairly accurate GHG base in order to calculate what generation is actually incrementing to serve California load. So I think that is great. In terms of your focus, I think that, you know, you're focusing on option two, but recognizing that a bridge solution may be needed. We're hopeful that there will be a bridge solution that won't need you to change the algorithm, but I guess that needs to be worked through. And then the final comment I would make is that, you know, as we look at the EIM with more BAs joining and more transmission transfer capability, and as we pour through the data, we are finding that it looks like a bridging solution, in our view, is needed and is needed fairly quickly. We are now seeing from the data that is out there publicly that, you know, interval after interval, hour after hour, some of the BAs that have substantial fossil fuels are importing to California, which means the challenge, which might have been relatively small when the EIM first started running, is growing as more BAs join, as more transmission is added to the footprint. And so we think a bridging solution needs to be done, but we're hopeful that that shouldn't need to detract from your focus on option two, which is the right long-term solution.
Okay, thanks.
Melissa will take the next question.
Hi, can you explain the first bullet, please?
So the first bullet on avoid full unit commitment by using prior unit commitment from second pass?
Yes.
So when we do our multi-interval optimization today, we solve for determining the optimal energy as well as the optimal unit commitment for all resources. And what we're saying is by removing the unit commitment portion and using the results from a prior run, we basically assume that that's the correct decision, and so that simplifies the solution to solving from an energy standpoint with the resources that are already committed. We don't need to determine which resources to commit.
So when you talk about prior unit run, is that the prior 5 minutes results from
correct. The prior 15-minute market.
Oh, okay. Prior 15.
Yeah, and there's a follow-up to that. Don is going to get into some slides soon describing our vision for the real-time market, which will eventually bridge this gap and bring it down to a 5-minute delay instead of the 15-minute that we have today. So it's going to get better.
So I'm just trying to understand how we're going to use the solution from a prior run, especially when you have a very different characteristic of a load, especially in the working hours or late at night, that might result in a different dispatch.
So when we say a prior run, we mean like the one that happened 15 minutes ago, not one that happened yesterday or in a different hour.
So there wouldn't be that much variation in picking up resources
That's correct, because the only concern you have is changes in system conditions between 15 minutes.
Okay, that's fair enough. Thank you.
Ellen.
Hi, Ellen Wolf. Just a short clarifying question. On this first bullet, this simplification applies to both the settlement first pass and the advisory first passes.
Yes. Helen, when we're referring to unit commitment, that is for the entire time horizon, so it affects all intervals, right?
Okay. If you end up doing this presentation again, I'm envisioning a table, you know, where you have these simplifications. Some of them apply to the settlement first pass, and some of them apply more to the advisory first passes. And just trying to get clear about what's happening is helpful. So this commitment, you'll never run commitment in the first pass,
right,
according to your current strategy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this is, you know, to understand what we're facing against is, as you know, the unit commitment, if it changes drastically, you have a completely different solution. And trying to find a greenhouse gas allocation base for a second pass using some completely different solution for the allocation base, you lose the connectivity in the problem.
And the
connectivity is coming from keeping those discontinuities, those binary variables set. If you allow them to change, you're going to go on a different solution, and it's going to be very hard to make any sense out of what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and I apologize. I wasn't meaning to question the soundness of your choice. I'm just trying to understand. So thanks.
Okay, question in the back.
John Hughes, NV Energy. So with the changes to the optimization for GHG, how is that going to affect other optimization changes going forward, the other real-time market?
Well, that's a good segue to my next slide.
Okay, perfect.
So as everyone knows, we're in the process of our roadmap prioritization, and the one that we had prioritized the highest was our real-time market enhancements initiative. This is to significantly, basically continue to improve our ability to integrate renewable resources. And if you think about it, from the overall objectives of this entire thing, in terms of reducing the amount of carbon through the energy sector, the ability to integrate higher and higher and higher levels of renewables is the easiest, or is the most effective way to that you actually accomplish that. And so in this initiative, our plan is to walk through integrating the 15-minute market and the 5-minute and RTD into a single market optimization. So currently, the 15-minute market uses our real-time unit commitment process, which is anywhere from 4 to 7 15-minute intervals. And the real-time dispatch is a rolling 12 5-minute interval dispatch. And so we would now basically run everything in a 2-hour, 5-minute interval market optimization. So you would get your 15-minute market schedules and your 5-minute real-time dispatch from the same market run. And so that has lots of efficiency benefits because you're using consistent assumptions between the two markets, and you have some tangential benefits where you actually can pull in the market timeline by approximately 10 minutes because you're using RTD versus the 50-minute interval RTUC. Another huge benefit of this is rather than committing units, which we only do in the real-time unit commitment process, in 15-minute intervals, we now can commit resources on a 5-minute interval basis. So we would now co-optimize in the 5-minute dispatch unit commitment as well as energy to where now we just look at energy. We're also going to move the 5-minute ancillary services procurement, which is currently performed only in real-time unit commitment and only to procure incremental to the day-ahead forecast. We would now move to where we're procuring ancillary services on a 5-minute basis with a full resettlement, similar to the our flexible ramping product. So again, this helps pull additional flexibility out from your reserves. And as many of you may know, we also have moved market power mitigation out of the 15-minute market and have now and will be implementing in early next year, moving that into a 5-minute market standpoint. So we need to make sure that the functionality of that for the first pass that we're putting in place is consistent and we'll work with so that we can achieve these enhancements, which are far greater to reducing carbon in both the ISO and the West, because now we can integrate even more renewable resources than we can today by putting these types of enhancements in place. So, and this still remains the number one on the priority list for lots of people. So now I'm going to move into highlighting that issue that we sort of touched on a little bit in terms of this, what is California supply and why do you need to think of things as California supply? So let's assume that there's a California load serving entity that's contracted with a RIND resource that's located in Oregon. If you only use the location where that resource was actually located in the first pass, you could get some pretty interesting results that I don't think California load serving entities would be happy with. So if we did this, you know, a wind resource, let's assume it's bidding 0 megawatts, and it's always going to be scheduled to its forecast. And in that first pass, if it was just done based upon where it was located, it would be dispatched to its forecast. It would serve load outside of California, even though it was contracted with a California LSE, and its GHG allocation base would basically be its forecast. And as a result of it being at its forecast, it can't ever be incrementally dispatched in the second pass. So the fact that, for instance, that in this example, that wind resource was dispatched up at its forecast, which allowed a emitting resource to be back down, that resource that was back down, the emitting one, is the only one that has headroom to be dispatched up. So even though, so what this results in is that transfer could only be supported by a GHG emitting resource, increasing the cost beyond what that California load serving entity paid through its contract with that wind resource in Oregon. So you have to now, rather than think about where the resource is located, you need to think about which state's supply it really is. And in this case, you don't want to include that Oregon wind resource in the first pass because that should be considered part of the California optimization. Ellen.
Hi, Ellen Wolf. Can you explain why when the unit is dispatched up in the first pass, it can't be incrementally dispatched in the second pass?
So it's going to be economic. So if you think about this resource, and let's assume that the energy price is not negative. So any a zero-priced variable energy resource is always going to be dispatched at its forecast. And we're going to use the same forecast in the two passes. So when you dispatch it up to its forecast, you can't dispatch it above the forecast because there's no ability to make the wind blow stronger.
Okay, by forecast you mean?
Its output.
You're going to dispatch it full on,
yeah.
And it's got no headroom left.
Right.
unless you have an oversupply situation. You're going to just max out all the zero energy priced resources.
Correct.
Okay.
We'll go to the question on the phone.
Hi, Donna. It's Mark Holman at PowerX.
Yep.
I think this is a very important point, but maybe I'm a slide early here. I think when you talk through in slide 25 what the solution to that is, I think just maybe some fine-tuning of that. I think that if you have a resource outside the state that is under a long-term renewable contract to a California LSE or is providing resource adequacy to a California LSE, then it's appropriate for that resource to be treated as a California resource. But I don't think it should go as far as to say any resource that has a contract with an LSE is a California resource. Otherwise, we'll get some strange results. For example, if a resource that really isn't meeting California's RA or renewable requirements, but is just selling its output day ahead, if the LSE imports it into California, it's treated one way, and if someone else imports it, it's treated a different way. So I think that just some fine-tuning on this concept might be important to really identify that it's those external resources that are under a renewable contract or under an RA commitment to California should be treated as California resources, and the rest should not. I'm not sure how clear that was.
And I appreciate that. And again, any thoughts, Brad, that in your comments? I think we had always envisioned that it wasn't that we wouldn't do some validation, for instance, that only a California load serving entity scheduling coordinator could flag this. So we'd sort of considered that anybody could self-identify itself, and what that self-identification means from a compliance standpoint was something we would work out from the fine details. But we didn't want to get into where we were validating based upon SCIDs or some other mechanism validating whether that what they've represented to us on that was correct.
I understood and appreciate that. And we'll put this in our comments, but I think rather than it being an option to identify, I think perhaps it should just be a requirement that if a resource or a portion of a resource is under an RA contract or under a renewable contract to California, then it needs to be flagged that way so that it's consistently treated that way. I think if you get into optionality of participants being able to flag it, I'm just concerned that there could be some unintended consequences of that. It really, from our perspective, should be pretty black and white, that if it's under an NRPS or an RA obligation, then it is flagged, and if it's not, it's not flagged.
So those, I think, we're in complete agreement, but I do think there may be instances where, for instance, a California load-serving entity is underscheduled accidentally in the day-ahead time frame, and they go make a spot market transaction bilaterally that they then bid into the HASP schedule into the HASP. That might be appropriate to treat that as California supply too. So that's what we were trying to allow.
Yeah. I'm not sure we agree with that, but we'll put it in our comments. Looking forward to further discussions. Okay, thanks.
Melissa, we'll take the next question.
Hi, this is Wade from SCE. Well, thank you for the explanation. I think it makes sense to consider the resource out of state contact with the LSEs in this way as you describe it, but I'm trying to understand from market perspective, if say a state or Pacific Corp joins the day-ahead market, I think the transfer in the day-ahead between the ISO and the Pacific Corp in that regime would be zero, except the LSE contracted resource. Am I understanding this right?
Well, in the first pass, that's correct. So in the first pass, you would not allow transfers from non-California supply to serve California load.
And also in the day-ahead market, because you don't consider EIM entities in the day-ahead time frame, so that won't be an issue. But if you move to the real time, in the first pass round, what are you going to consider for the energy transfer? If, say, Pacific already joins ISO, now you've got a you know, the state or PTOs that mm-hmm. cut off the single BA market, and also you got a EIM. So how you would consider the energy transfer, where would include the, you know, the entity already generalized, so day-ahead market, plus entities that are just the EIM entities.
So you would have the same, and I think we get into this in the afternoon session, but you'd have the same concept that you would, in the day-ahead time frame, you would, in terms of everyone participating in the day-ahead market, you would have a California supply and you would have non-California supply. You'd optimize the non-California supply first, then you co-optimize both of them together, and that gets your day-ahead schedules. And then when you come into real time, you have the same approach. You have California supply, non-California supply. You optimize the non-California supply in the first pass, and then add and allow incremental transfers in the second pass.
Okay, so if I can, I think if that entity or Pacifico not joining ISO and this proposal in the real-time market, the EIM energy transfer will become zero in the first pass round, but it still allows imports and exports between the market, between the ISO, California State, and outside in the first pass round. But
correct.
If that entity joins the day-ahead market, then you will redo everything in that state or in that PTO, so it will become zero except for this LSE contact resource. Is that right? Or
So I don't see any. So the way to think of it is, in the real-time market, we do. With the EIM is part of the real-time market, so you may have more non-California supply. In the day-ahead market, you have, if it just remains the ISO as it is today, 99% of it is California load and California supply. In the if PacifiCorp joined, you'd now have 70% California supply and 30% non-California supply and non-California load, and you would still do the two first pass solution. So I think two pass solution. The first pass where you don't allow non-California supply to serve California load, and the second pass you then allow that to occur. You would it'd be the same. The only difference is that as you get to real-time market, there's more non-California supply available on a 5-minute basis than there was in the day ahead.
Okay, I see. Thanks.
Question.
Nora Sheriff for Quica. Do you know off the top of your head the percentage of California load for the EIM market?
If you go back to one of my earlier slides, I actually used load from a given day. You could probably ballpark it there in my examples earlier. Yep, go to the phone.
Melissa, we'll go ahead and take a question in queue.
Caller, you may have your phone on mute. Go ahead. Hello? Caller, you may have
your phone on mute.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. My question about the zero, the bit of $0, is it per megawatt or per GHG emission?
So in my example here on slide 24, I assumed that this resource was willing to be deemed delivered to California, so it would have bid a $0 per megawatt hour energy bid for its total output, and it would have bid its PMAX for its GHG megawatt bid and bid $0 for its GHG bid adder.
Sorry, I'm confused because I thought when bidders bid a $0 per megawatt hours, they're not considered to support California load.
No, that's not true.
Okay.
It's only if the GHG bid adder, they bid a 0 megawatt quantity.
Yeah, there are two parts to the greenhouse gas bid, the megawatt and the price. So the megawatt can be zero, saying basically I don't want to be getting attribution for serving load to California. So if you have a non-zero megawatt quantity, you may get an attribution for that amount.
So isn't this a zero per megawatt hour bid then? I'm sorry, I'm confused.
So the bid I've placed here is for energy, in my example on slide 24. I did not explicitly call out the GHG bid.
Okay. My second question is, why isn't this considered an import if it's contracted?
Can you ask that again?
Why isn't this resource considered an import if it is contracted with California, if it has a contract with California?
So again, when we do the energy imbalance market, we're dispatching at a resource-specific level. There may be an import between the that's tagged that we assume is deemed delivered between the two balancing authority areas. But we then, when we move into the real-time market and the energy imbalance market, we dispatch individual specific resources, and the total aggregation of the, all those resources dispatches are the transfers that occur between the balancing authority areas.
I guess that's, sorry, I'm not following because I thought you mentioned something about imports to serve California load will have no constraint in the model, and then the EIM transfers are the ones that would have constraints.
Yeah. Let's simplify the example here. Let's assume that this resource does not participate in the day-ahead market. Let's say status quo today. And it is in Pacific Corp's territory, so it's an EIM participating resource. What Dawn is trying to illustrate here is that because this resource has a contract to serve California load, we have to treat it a little different in our solution compared to other EIM resources that they don't have such a contract. Okay? Because if we don't, okay, what this example here shows is that if we do the first pass solution, that resource being very cheap, it may be dispatched in that first pass solution to serve non-California load, all right, and then it has now a greenhouse gas base allocation that is at its forecast. So now in the second pass solution, obviously, because there's no incremental dispatch from that base, it will not get an allocation to serve California load, and that's counterintuitive if you consider the fact that it has a contract with a California LSE to serve California load, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. But can you explain about what type of constraint then would you do for such loads that have contracts? And I'm kind of still equating that with imports, for example, with RPS contracts and whatnot. For such loads, how are you treating, for such resources, how are you treating those in the model to constrain those resources to serving loads?
So let me move to my next slide where I explain how we actually model this in the market. So to point out, we need to be able to identify which supply is included in the first pass and which supply to determine the GHG allocation base for any resource located outside of California. So load-serving entities or resource owners, when they set up that resource, the scheduling coordinator will identify if the resource is California supply in the master file. That's whether it's, and that's for any resource. So if you think about any resource in California, the answer is yes. For resources outside of California, it's whether or not that resource is contracted with the California load-serving entity. Now, as we know, resources can sometimes be contracted to multiple parties for different periods and all of that, and we support multiple resource IDs at the same location. It's not a big deal from a modeling and setting up standpoint. So again, they will set that resource up as whether or not it's California supply. Now, for all supply located outside of the California state boundary, they will bid a separate GHG component. And this is because, as is done today, let's say that California LSE is contractor of the resource. In this case, I've assumed it's a resource adequacy resource. And that resource has met all of its must-offer obligations. You know, it bid into the real day-ahead market. It doesn't have a flexible RA requirement, so it doesn't have to bid into real time. It doesn't clear the day-ahead market. There is nothing that says that that resource can't then, outside of the ISO's market, be bilaterally transacted with some other party that's not California. So we want that to still be able to occur within the market optimization. So we can have that occur by having a separate GHG bid. So if that resource is not attributed to supporting load in California, it can then serve load outside of California without that GHG cost because it doesn't have a compliance obligation with CARB. Because one, the generator is located outside the state of California and it's serving non-California load. Now, we still to implement that, we still need to actually come up with a GHG allocation base for these types of resources. And in these resources, we simply use the base schedule that they've submitted. And that's because, as we sort of talked about, it would be logical for these resources to be in the day-ahead time frame importing into California. Thus, they would have a base schedule where the generator is at, let's say, 100 megawatts, supporting a 100 megawatt export out of the EIM entity BAA that supports 100 megawatt import into the California ISO. So you want to keep that recognize that only when they're dispatched above that will they actually be able to serve California load in the EIM standpoint from an attribution standpoint. And this addresses a concern that was raised that is there a potential where a resource that's in this scenario that's importing day ahead to California, are we double counting the green emissions of it? And so by putting this rule in, we address that concern. Currently, the only way that a resource can avoid the potential of getting double allocated or double attributed once through the import and once through the EIM was to opt out of being attributed for delivery to California. So that's how we would propose to identify California supply and model it appropriately. Ellen.
Hi, Ellen Wolf. I have a couple questions. On this last bullet point, do you mean their allocation base, sort of the second pass result? You would deem their second pass result to be equal to that base schedule?
No, or their first pass result. Remember, the first pass is where you come up with the GHG allocation base. So we would we would go through and do it, and then we would just say that the GHG allocation base for this external resource contract with California is the base schedule that was submitted.
Okay, so if there is headroom on the resource, it still has the opportunity to be then dispatched incrementally for
to serve California
plans.
Load and not right.
Is all of this information that you've included on this slide relevant for only EIM areas?
So again, remember we're talking the paradigm shift has changed from balance and authority area. It's to that California supply versus non-California supply.
Okay.
So this is only relevant to California supply.
But this resource is not
located geographically in California.
It's not geographically located in California. It's in a non-greenhouse gas regulation area, but it has a contract to serve load in a greenhouse gas regulation area. So we consider it as part of the supply for that greenhouse gas regulation area when we do the first pass.
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole thing. We have to treat it separately from other resources.
External.
We have to treat it the same or in a similar manner with California supply here. So when we put a constraint that says we don't want exports from the non-California region to the California region, that resource is not part of that constraint.
Okay. But so when it comes to the second pass, if this resource is not located in an EIM, will it still be dispatched up in your second pass, or what?
If it's not located in an EIM balancing authority area, then it would be a traditional import, which we are not, may not be, unless it's a dynamic scheduled resource directly with the ISO, would we be doing a resource-specific dispatch of it.
Okay, so then I'll go back to my last question. This is only for supply that's located in EIM areas, because the rest are treated traditionally?
Well, so, no, but you're getting to the next point that we need to make when you go to how do you treat imports and exports into a multi-state balancing authority area?
Okay.
And
so
an importer and export can serve anything in the multi-state balance. So by default, it's in the non-GHG regime.
Yeah, and I understand that for the end game in a regional design, but for this interim, just EIM-only application, this resources that you're talking about doing this for are only the ones that are located in EIM areas that are available to be dispatched as part of the EIM solution.
Okay, so you're saying, sorry, go ahead, Christine.
So this is Christine from Pacific Corps. So the way I'm understanding, I'm having struggling in the same way Ellen is. Is it both a resource that's contracted with an LLC in California and an EIM participating resource?
I think that's the focus here is on a resource that is in non-California area, not in a greenhouse gas regulation area. Okay, and you see as the paradigm shifts, you can have a resource that is, let's say, in PacifiCorp today, okay, which PacifiCorp is an EIM entity, but it's outside California. So this has to be treated as California supply because it has a contract potentially with an LLC serving load in California. Or we have to change another paradigm and say that, let's say this resource is in Monoville Power Administration, and it bids as an import at Malin, which is an ISO scheduling point. We don't see the resource. We see a bid at Malin, okay? In a multi-regional solution, what Don was saying is that this imported energy, all right, may be actually serving load not in California. So, because it could wheel through the ISO. Okay? So in that paradigm, you have to consider that this resource, this import, has also a greenhouse gas bid if it is attributed, if it gets an attribution to serve California load, all right? Because the energy that goes into the EIM footprint, it can serve, it can get an attribution for serving California load or not.
Yeah, and so I think we're about 20 minutes behind schedule, and I think that we get into a lot of these issues when you look at the end of the afternoon on the slides that I think will help make this more clear, and you'll see how, because once you introduce another GHG regime, you see why you need to have these various treatments of this and have to move away. It's not balancing authority area based. It's not where the resource is located and why you need that. So I think, are there any questions on the phone or can we?
I think at this time, let's just go ahead and break for lunch. We'll come back at 1:20. If there are any remaining questions from folks on the phone, you're welcome to email those to me. I'm actually going to pull up a slide that has my email address on it. So you can email those to me, and I'll send them on to Don and George to respond to. So we'll meet back here at 1:20.
Hello, everybody. So this is going to be the workshop session of our meeting. So we're going to go through the spreadsheet that we have released that has the examples and the models. We released this spreadsheet for illustrative purposes. It's for you to understand how the models work and show you the examples. You can actually use this as a tool to modify the examples and run what-if scenarios or make your own examples, okay? We provide this as is. We don't provide support for this tool. So if you break it, don't call the ISO. So Let me start by saying that your Excel installation needs the solver add-in for this, which if it's not in your installation, you can go to the options and go to the add-ins. You can see that it shows as active here. If it's not active, you go down to the bottom, manage Excel add-ins, make sure you activate it, okay? So that enables this button called Solver in the Data tab that runs the model. Okay, so there are two models in the spreadsheet, what we call Model A and Model J, run for several scenarios, about 11 scenarios with examples. We won't go through all the scenarios, we'll go through the interesting ones. So the Model A is the status quo. And I'm going to use scenario 10 to illustrate how you run the model, and then we'll go through the scenarios from the beginning. So when you look at this and you want to use this tool, anything that appears black, it's either a constant or a formula, so don't alter those cells. Blue cells are input, so you can alter those. That's how you can change the example. You can run what-if scenarios. Anything that you see red is a decision variable, so that is calculated by the solver. Okay, so let's do a demonstration here. So let me delete this and have the solver recalculate them. So you go to the data tab, you run the solver. Okay, so this is the Model A that is fully linear. And when you solve this, you get the solution, the megawatts, as you can see they're populated, the dispatch and the allocation. Remember, Model A does a greenhouse gas allocation starting from 0 megawatts, okay? There is no greenhouse gas base. We list it here, but it's not used by this model. It's used in the Model J, the two-pass model. If you want to find out the prices, you can click here the sensitivity portion, click OK, you get the sensitivity report, and that part of the sensitivity report has the shadow prices of our constraints. That's what I usually copy in every cell here. So that's how these prices are coming out here. They're coming from the sensitivity report. Any questions on Model A and how you run it? It's pretty simple, right? Just press a button. All right? Okay. Model J is our two-pass solution, and it's a little bit more complicated, and as you can see, going from A through J, we went through a process, a discovery process, to perfect it, and finally we arrived at what we think is a good model. So this one has a first pass, which we don't code it in the model, because these are simplified examples. So we calculate the greenhouse gas base as the optimal solution with no exports to California. And in our model, we consider basically two regions, the California ISO and all the EIM entities combined as one region that doesn't have greenhouse gas regulation, because our attribution, our greenhouse gas attribution process really does not distinguish between the different EIM balancing authority areas. They're all treated like one area that doesn't have greenhouse gas regulation. All right. So this is our example. All our examples are based on this model, where we have a generator in the ISO and load in the ISO, and three generators with different bids in the rest of the non-California area with the load. Now, the difference with Model J is in the second pass, the greenhouse gas allocation is not starting from 0 megawatts for the dispatch. It's only allocating up to the incremental dispatch. To calculate the incremental dispatch, we compare the dispatch, which is the optimal solution, with the greenhouse gas base, which is the optimal solution with no exports to California. Now, in general, you can have a dispatch which is above or below the base. Okay? So in order to recognize in the model what is above the base and what is below the base, we have to introduce a binary variable here that takes the value of 1 if the dispatch is greater than or equal to the base. And then this help us to calculate what we call incremental dispatch, which now becomes the lower bound, sorry, the upper bound for the greenhouse gas allocation. So in this two-pass model, the second pass does not allocate unless you have an incremental dispatch. And we will see this in our examples. So going through the various scenarios, you'll see that the dispatch between Model A and Model J could be different, and the prices could be different. Now, this model, you can run it the same way. Again, I'm going to remove this solution here to show you that really the model runs and calculates it. So this is exactly the same. You run the model. All right. You get the solution. But here, there's no sensitivity tab. Okay. Why is that? Because here we have a discontinuity. We have binary variables. So this model does not give you the prices. The prices, you need to run sensitivity. So to find the prices, we have to create what we call the crossover model. The crossover model is the same model as this one, but we freeze the binary variables. We freeze them at the same solution that we got before. Once you freeze the binary variables, and this is what we do today in our market solution, we always end up with a crossover solution to find the prices. Once you freeze those, then the problem becomes continuous, and now if you solve it again, of course you get the same megawatt solution, but now you get a sensitivity answer because now the problem is continuous, and that will give you now prices. And that's how we get the shadow prices for the constraints on the J model. It's a two-step process. All right? So this is how you can use the model. Now, I'm going to stop briefly to see if you have any questions on the mechanics, because, you know, if you're not familiar with Excel, this may be new to you. And if not, we can go through the various examples. Do we have any questions on the phone? All right, good. Everybody understands this. All right, so let's start simple with scenario one. So each scenario, we solve it with the model A, which is the status quo, okay, what we have now in production, and with model J, which is our two-pass approach. So scenario A is simple, okay, it resembles the scenario that Don had an example earlier. So we have the ISO generation being at $36, and we have two generators in the rest of the EIM area with prices 35 at 20. The generator G3 also has a greenhouse gas price of 12. G2 is a non-emitting resource, so it has a zero price. So when we solve this, okay, the optimal solution, and I'm listing also the greenhouse gas base allocation. We're going to use this in the second model. That would be the optimal solution with no exports to California. Obviously, the 200 megawatt load outside of California will be met by the $20 resource, so that's your optimal solution. That's your allocation base. Again, Model A does not use the allocation base. This is used for the two-pass solution. So the current solution, this is your optimal solution. G2 and G3 are the cheapest resources in terms of energy, so they're going to be loaded fully, and the remaining 100 megawatts to serve the ISO load will be the $36 resource. And when we do the allocation, currently we don't observe any greenhouse gas base. We start from zero and we go to the cheapest resource. So that will be the non-emitting resource of G2. We'll get the 200 megawatt allocation for the 200 exports into California. Okay, so that's the current solution. Now, this is similar to the example that Don showed earlier. Okay, when you see in the optimal solution, these 200 megawatts that is generated by G3 was going to be dispatched anyway. It's in the base. You can see it here because it's a $20 resource. So here you don't have secondary dispatch. All the incremental dispatch to serve California load is coming from a new resource that was not in the base. So we don't have the effect of a secondary dispatch. So when we go to the two-pass solution, the two-pass solution gives you exactly the same dispatch and exactly the same allocation. The allocation is to the non-emitting resource because it has an incremental dispatch, 200 megawatts compared to its base. And we allocate on the incremental dispatch, the GHG allocation, this guy here. And the prices are the same. The price all over the network is $36 because this is the marginal resource. G1 is the only resource that has that is not at its limit. So any additional megawatt, either at the ISO or outside California, is served by the $36, so the prices are $36. You can see it here. It's the saddle price of the power balance constraint. That's $36, nothing else is there. So here is a simple scenario where you don't have secondary dispatch, where your two-pass solution will give you exactly the same results with what we have today from the status quo solution. Okay? Questions on this? Good. Yes?
When do you need 300 megawatts for GHG allocation for California load for L1?
There is still 100 megawatts being generated by G1.
So also, that's staying internally. Okay.
Right. So because the other two generators hit their limit, right? 200 megawatts is their upper limit, the maximum. So you're going to take them first because they're cheaper. So you're going to get 400 megawatts total generation from these generators, and then the remaining 100 megawatt of load is served by G1. So the export to California is 200 megawatts. So you need an allocation of 200. Again, the attribution, the greenhouse gas attribution, does not consider any resource or network constraints. There is only one constraint that guides the allocation, that you have to allocate every megawatt of what is exported to California, you have to allocate it to the resources with greenhouse gas bids. So you have, this is the only constraint. So you have to allocate 200 megawatts of the export to these resources. You go by their greenhouse gas bid. This is the cheapest non-emitting resource at zero, so you give it the allocation. Okay? So G2 will have a greenhouse gas responsibility for 200 megawatts. And it's the same in both solutions because G2 had the greenhouse gas base allocation of zero. The base allocation is ignored in the first solution. It is taken into consideration in the two-pass solution, but because it was zero for this resource, the two solutions are the same. This is not going to be the same for other scenarios. I'm starting with something simple that both models give you exactly the same solution, okay? All right. So let's move to the next scenario. In the next scenario, we make G2 cheaper, right? So G2 is $10. Now it's cheaper than G3. Remember, in scenario one, the greenhouse gas base had G3 at dispatch because it was $20 compared to $35. In this scenario, the base changes because G2 is cheaper than G3 for serving non-California load, so the base becomes 200 at G2. So now, because of this change, the optimal solution is still the same in megawatts. You still have 200 megawatt exports to California, and G1 has to make the balance of 100 megawatts, but now the difference will be in the allocation. Model A does not see this difference in the base because it's not relevant. Okay, we always allocate from zero, so it will make the same allocation, giving 200 megawatts greenhouse gas responsibility to G2 as before because G2 is non-emitting. However, if you look at the two-pass solution, let me make it a little smaller. In the two-pass solution now, G2 has a base of 200. It's dispatched at 200. There is no incremental dispatch. So this model cannot allocate greenhouse gas responsibility to G2. So it will allocate greenhouse gas responsibility to G3 because G3 has an incremental dispatch of 200 megawatts. So the dispatch is the same, but the greenhouse gas responsibility is different. This model allocates the 200 megawatt exports to California to G3, because G3 has an incremental dispatch, all right? So in this scenario, we do have secondary dispatch, right? G2 would have been dispatched to serve non-California load anyway. You can see it from the base. So the dispatch of G3 is because of the solution that now includes the California load. So G3 is the secondary dispatch. So now this methodology, Model J, allocates the greenhouse gas allocation to G3, recognizing that this is the secondary dispatch. Okay, so that's where you have a difference between the two models. And of course, because the greenhouse gas allocation is different, you also have different prices here. So if we go to the Model A, the only price that exists here is $36 for G1, which is the marginal resource. And both California and non-California have a marginal price of $36. But with the two-pass solution, this model, Model J, makes an allocation to an emitting resource now, which has a greenhouse gas price of $12. So now this creates a $12 saddle price for the greenhouse gas allocation constraint, which creates now a price differential between California and non-California. The price in California is 36. The price outside California is 36 minus 12, 24. Is it clear why? We have one additional megawatt of load to serve outside California. The only generator that can serve this load is G1, because the other two are at their maximum, correct? So this will become 101. And the export to California will reduce from 200 to 199. So that will reduce the greenhouse gas allocation from 200 to 199. Saving $12 greenhouse gas responsibility cost. So $36 for the cost of energy minus $12 savings on the greenhouse gas cost is $24, and that's the marginal price outside California. Okay? Any questions? All right. So let's go to scenario 3. So far we have seen scenario 2, same dispatch, different prices. So in scenario 3, we change the problem to have also different dispatch. So we do that by making generator G3 more expensive than G1 for serving California load. In scenario 2, the price of G3 is 20, its greenhouse gas is 12, the total is 32, which is less than 36. When we go to scenario 3, we increase the energy price of G3 to 32, so now plus 12, 44, becomes more expensive for serving California load than G1. So the solution here will be different with the two pass. The first pass, we have the same base, there's exactly the same dispatch, okay? Still, G2 and G3 are cheaper for energy than G1, so they're fully dispatched, and still 100 megawatts from G1 to serve the remaining load in California. And the allocation goes to non-emitting resource, so there's no difference with the previous solution for the Model A, for the current model. But there will be a different solution for the two-pass. We look at the two-pass solution. Look what happens here. Because G2 does not have an incremental dispatch, because the dispatch of 200 and 200 was its base, that's the optimal solution for serving non-California load without exports to California, okay? Same as before. You can't allocate to G2. You can only allocate to G3. And that's what we saw in the previous scenario. But in this scenario, you will not allocate to G3 because G3 is more expensive than G1 for serving California load because of the $12 greenhouse gas cost. So what the model will do, it will not allocate any greenhouse gas energy and will let the California load be served by G1 at 300 megawatts. So you have a materially different dispatch here. The price is the same as the previous solution of the current model, $36. That's the marginal generator in ISO. Assume that it can generate more than 300. So the difference here is that in the previous scenario, some of the generation for G1 was substituted from G3 because G3 was cheaper than G1 in serving California load, considering the greenhouse gas price. Here, this doesn't happen. And this model is capable of realizing this, so it results in no exports to California because that would be more expensive. The current model that allocates from zero will allocate to G2 and will have a secondary dispatch from G3 and will result in different dispatch solution. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I expect some.
Emily, we'll go ahead and take the first question. Just a reminder to identify yourself first, please.
Hi, Lindsay Sluckaway from NV Energy.
Can you please speak up a little louder so that we can hear you?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
A little better, yes.
Okay. I don't understand the first pass that you're explaining on this model because you have an export going to California.
Sure.
From the EIM.
So the first pass is what I highlight here, what we call greenhouse gas base, which is the optimal dispatch with zero transfer to California. In reality, zero exports to California. You can see that this is 200 for G2, 0 for G3, and 0 for G4. So that's where your question is, correct?
Yes, but I thought the first pass was being done on A, and J was the second pass. I guess
no. No, let me clarify. So A and J are two different models, okay? The model A is what we have currently in production, where the greenhouse gas allocation base is not even a factor. It's not being considered, and the greenhouse gas allocation is going from 0 megawatts up to the dispatch. So it doesn't realize any restriction for allocating only to incremental dispatch. Okay, so this is what we have today. The model J is the two-pass solution where the first pass is what we have here as input in the greenhouse gas base column. And I don't need to run a model to find that optimal solution because this is a simple example. We can see by inspection that the optimal solution is 200 for G2 and 0 for the others. So that constitutes now the greenhouse gas allocation base so that then when this model solves the second pass, the greenhouse gas allocation is restricted to be less than or equal to the incremental dispatch. So here, because there is no incremental dispatch for G2, it's zero, it can't allocate anything to G2, which is the correct outcome because G2 would have run anyway to serve non-California load. All right?
Okay.
It would allocate to G3, but G3 is more expensive than G1, so it doesn't make any allocation in this scenario.
Okay, great.
Does this answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you. Sure.
Okay, Emily, we'll take the next question.
This is Ezra Hausman. I asked you earlier whether the step one affects the dispatch in step two, and I'm trying to follow this, your discussion. I'm curious, is this an example where you can demonstrate that the solving step one first actually changes the dispatch in step two?
So when you solve for the step one, which we have here as an input, because this is your limit to how much greenhouse gas allocation you can make to in the second step, obviously your first step solution could affect the second pass solution. So in the previous scenario, let me illustrate that here in this scenario. Let's say I'm going to change the optimal base. I'm going to make it 150, if I can do that. 150 on G2 and 50 on G3, right? Now, if I solve the model, the 200 dispatch for G2 will leave room for a 50 megawatt of allocation here, right? Before it was 200, 200, there was no incremental dispatch and no allocation. So if I run it now, see what happens now? The model sees that there is a 50 megawatt incremental dispatch on G2, so now it will go ahead and allocate 50 megawatt of greenhouse gas responsibility, and there will be a 50 megawatt export to California, and G1 will back off from 300 to 250. So your base can affect the optimal solution of the second pass. You see why, right? Because the allocation is on the incremental dispatch, which compares the optimal dispatch with the base. So if you change your base, you change how much allocation you can make, and that could have a material impact on the dispatch, on the optimal dispatch for the second pass, right? I just demonstrated that, okay?
I see. And if I understand this, if I can take it one more step, allocated that 50 megawatts. Since you already have that serving load outside, it's kind of assuming it's doing that at a price of 32, whereas if that were serving load in California, it would have to be a price of 44. So it can hold on to that at the lower price and just kind of set, I hate to use the word deemed, but to be serving the EIM load and not the California load.
Okay, I couldn't follow you exactly, but once we have a 50 megawatt allocation for... Say again?
Well, you had an optimal solution before, and you have an optimal solution now. They're different.
Yes.
And I'm trying, and I guess that's because the 50 megawatts at G3 that you kind of put in there by hand,
yes,
that's in the GHG base. The model basically assumes that that's serving EIM load, but doesn't
correct
worry about the fact that it would be $44 to serve California because it's $32 to serve the EIM load.
That is correct. So G3 doesn't get an allocation, although it has, first of all, it doesn't have an incremental dispatch, so it wouldn't have gotten an allocation, but even if it had some incremental dispatch, it would still not get an allocation because its total cost for serving California load would be 44, which is more expensive than 36. But for G2, because the cost for serving California load is only $10, and because it has a 50 megawatt incremental dispatch, it will get a 50 megawatt allocation, and that will allow a 50 megawatt export to California, serving California load. So yes, your first pass solution could affect the second pass solution because the second pass is dependent on your first pass and what you consider to be your greenhouse gas allocation base. Okay?
So what would you have said the price was in, I'm sorry, with the previous solution? I know you just changed it, but the price was...
I didn't change it because I didn't brought the prices. This is what it was before. G1 was marginal, setting the price at $36, both in California and non-California. Here...
But G1 was also fully dispatched.
No, you're talking about the price before. So the price before is 36. If I want to calculate the price here, I have to run the crossover model. I don't know if you want me to do that.
Oh, I see. You have to do it. Okay.
Yeah, I have to cross this over. So I can do it. Just my screen is too small.
So now you're running a crossover model for J? I mean for 3?
Yes, but I have to carry it over here. make sure I have the correct values. So that's the crossover one. Now we have to make sure that we have exactly the same inputs. So let me get the inputs from here.
I admire your
fly
with other people watching. But we actually I wanted to go back to the previous solution without the 50 at T3.
You wanted to see the prices on the change I made, right? So
previous ones are no, without the change where T1 was fully dispatched. So the previous.
Okay, this was 36, right? Because we haven't changed it. It's still what it was here. So the marginal price before I made the change was $36 set by G1.
Even though it
because
was
because G1 was marginal, right?
Well, it was fully dispatched. That's why I was confused about it.
Okay. You want me to go back to the same scenario as I had it before I made the change?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to be taking up.
So that was 200. The base was 200 here and zero, okay? Because $10 is the cheapest price to serve non-California loads, so it will be served by G2, so that's your base. And this was the optimal solution we got, where there was no export to California, because you couldn't allocate to G3, because it's more expensive for serving California load. So in this solution, your marginal resource is G1, and the cost for serving load either in California or outside California is $36. No.
Okay, it's just confusing because it's fully dispatched.
Yeah. It's fully dispatched. That's why I said at some point, and maybe it didn't resonate, assume that it has some more capacity. So if I make it 301 here, the maximum capacity, you still have the same dispatch solution, and the price is going to be 36 without the degeneracy. Was that your point, that G1 is fully maxed, so it wouldn't be able to set the price at 36? If that was your point, sorry, I missed it.
Yeah.
Was that your point? Okay, so right, so it's just the the inputs are unfortunate here. If I had it at 301, you still get the same dispatch, okay? And because now it's not capped at 300, you can see clearly that it sets the price at 36. So does that clarify your question there?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, because these are small examples and sometimes the solution lies exactly at the point where you have a constraint, you may have some degeneracy in the results. So, and that's why I'm using this tolerance here at some point, you'll see, to resolve this degeneracy. In here, assume that this generator G1 has some more capacity than 300 and then resolves the degeneracy, so you're now clearly, you can see that the price is $36, okay? But again, besides the issues with degeneracy, what I wanted to show here is that you have a materially different solution with the two-pass algorithm that doesn't make any allocation and doesn't allow any export to California, because according to its model economics, that is not going to be an optimal solution, because it is prevented from allocating to G2 because it doesn't have incremental dispatch, and it won't allocate to G3 because G3 in this example is more expensive than G1 in serving California load. Okay, so the outcome is much different. It's very different than the current approach that will allow a 200 megawatt export to California and will allow G3 to offset G1 in serving California load. Okay? Sure. Yeah, let's take them.
Emily, we'll go ahead and take the next question in the queue.
Hi, this is Ayat Osman from ORA again. Thank you for walking us through the spreadsheet. This is very helpful. I might be totally off base, but I feel that there is an interim step that we're missing to really understand the incremental dispatch to California. And maybe we can run a scenario offline on that, but how about if we consider the base case with an additional load equal to the California load? So you have your first run as you show it as GHG base, and then you have another base where you have an additional load equal to California load, but you're not considering the price of carbon. And in your third scenario, then you would run your customary dispatch.
Are you suggesting
the second step will get you? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm speculating, but I feel like we need to test this because the second step will really show the incremental the base case to run the load considering California's load without the additional cost of GHG. And that would be the base case that you would compare your incremental incremental dispatch to serve load in California.
Okay, if I understood you well, I think you were suggesting of using as a substitute for what we consider here the first pass, and now an alternative first pass solution on which we don't restrict exports to California, but we ignore the cost of greenhouse gas regulation? Is that what you suggested?
Correct. I think I want a three-step more or less to test it, because the first step makes sense, what would have happened in the market absent California load. The second step would be what would have happened if we consider California load in the mix without the restriction of GHG cost, without the regulation. And comparing the second step to the third step, which is adding the bid cost for GHG, will really get you to the incremental change or dispatch that happens due to the GHG that you can attribute to GHG policy.
Oh, I understand what you're saying, but and I would encourage you to submit in your comments an articulation of what you just said here so that we make sure we understand exactly what you propose. But the way I understood it, you're proposing a comparison of having a solution without greenhouse gas cost with having the solution with the greenhouse gas cost. And it's different than what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do here is we want to have a solution that, of course, has the greenhouse gas cost, but realizing the effect of secondary dispatch. So we have to make a distinction between the greenhouse gas cost that is relevant only for California load, and it's coming from resources that they were dispatched specifically because we had them in the optimization to serve California load, as opposed to what their dispatch would be without this export to California. So it's a different objective what you're trying to accomplish, and I, at this point here on the workshop, I can't put my fingers around it to provide comments. But if you send it in writing to us, we'll have a look at it and we'll provide a response.
Thank you.
But this is Don. I would add that if someone is suggesting that we move from a two-pass solution to a three-pass solution in real RTD, we're moving in the wrong direction in terms of making this a feasible solution.
Sorry, Don, if you got me wrong. I think we have a lot of time to experiment with this before we place in the market, you know, some model that might not accurately depict what happens due to the GHG policy. Much of the cost goes or incurred by ratepayers, and that's our motivation to be careful in constructing a really representative model of the what happens with the regulations here.
So, again, going back to my first suggestion, we would encourage you to articulate your proposal in your comments so that we can analyze it and understand it well so that we can provide an answer.
Thank you.
One more question. Okay, Emily, we'll go ahead and take Mark's question.
Hi, George. It's Mark Holman with PowerX.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Just a couple of questions slash points. The first question is, and maybe it might help with the previous example, the previous discussion, is that the first pass still allows energy to be wheeled through the CAISO balancing authority or through California. It's just saying, if I understand it correctly, it's saying what generation would have ran through the EIM dispatch without permitting California load to consume additional energy from EIM transfers. Is that
correct? You're correct. You're
so
correct. In the world that we have multiple transfers with multiple EIM balancing authority areas with the ISO, there is no restriction on any wheeling of energy transfers going through the ISO. The constraints formulated on the net import to the ISO or on the net export from all EIM balancing authority areas to the ISO.
So what it's really doing then is it's identifying any generation in the second pass that increases its production from the first pass is by definition increasing its production to serve load in California, and hence that is the generation that must be assigned the GHG allocation, and that is the generation including its GHG cost that must be considered in the dispatch and pricing solution.
So, Mark, you're very close. I will just make a slight modification. So I will say that any generator that its dispatch is increased compared to the greenhouse gas allocation base is eligible to get a greenhouse gas allocation, because when we get to some more complicated examples like the scenario 10, I will show you there that sometimes you may have incremental dispatch that does not get a greenhouse gas allocation or all
because
of it.
Because it's resolving congestion or for some
yes.
particular
yes.
subset. Maybe I'll say it the reverse way. Under this improved algorithm, GHG allocation would no longer be assigned to generation that would have ran anyways to serve load outside.
That is a correct statement.
And so I think, so maybe I'll go to my second point, which I think is an important one, I think it came up in two calls ago, is that I think that what this algorithm change does is pretty profound and goes a lot further than just accounting. It not only changes which generators have the reporting obligation, it obviously in doing that also changes how many carbon allowances are to be retired as a result of EIM transfers serving California load, but it also changes the dispatch and it also changes the pricing. And I think that means that we would likely see, once this algorithm is in place, less high GHG resources being dispatched outside of California to serve California load, a higher dispatch of clean resources outside being dispatched to serve California load, and some pretty profound impacts in a variety of areas, not just accounting, but also dispatch and pricing.
Mark, you're correct, because we solved one problem where we co-optimized the energy dispatch with the greenhouse gas responsibility allocation. So through that co-optimization, what looks like a simple accounting today for the greenhouse gas allocation actually becomes part of the co-optimized solution here. So you will have, and as I'm showing here in these examples, you have situations where the dispatch is different, but the price stays the same, or the dispatch is the same, but the price changes, or you have situations where both the dispatch and the prices change going to this new model.
Not only changes, but also changes in what I would describe as a beneficial way from the intent of the carbon program. It will discourage the dispatch of fossil fuels in the EIM to serve California load and increase the likelihood of clean resources being dispatched to serve load in California.
You know, I can't really make that statement because it really depends on the bids that they will be submitted, because we co-optimize energy and greenhouse gas costs, and it really depends on how the two relate to each other and with everything else. So, I mean, it's really difficult to say a statement clearly like that.
Fair enough. I guess you have to look at the specific example, and maybe I'll put it in our written comments, but I think it will have a profound effect systematically, that when you look across time, when you allocate GHG now to the resources that increase their production relative to the GHG base, that is going to make fossil fuels less competitive in being dispatched to serve load in California, all else equal, and it's going to make clean resources on a comparable basis more competitive to serve California load, which I think is consistent with the intent of the carbon program.
I think I will attest to that, Mark. Yes, if you say that all these resources are bidding the same energy price and the only differentiator is their emission cost and their greenhouse gas cost, then your statement is correct.
Okay. Thanks, George. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And actually, we couldn't have a more profound effect than what this example shows, where the current approach would have resulted in 200 megawatts export to California that would offset the generation of G1 from 300 to 100, whereas this two-pass model will result in no export to California and G1 generating 300 megawatts for serving California load. That exactly shows you how big the impact, at least in this small example, can be. Do we have any more questions? All right. Yes.
I'm sorry, I haven't opened the spreadsheet yet, but on the cover sheet, does it explain why the objective function changes for, I thought it would stay the same for each scenario.
When you say the cover sheet, you mean the description tab?
Is that defined in there, the objective function, and why it's changing for each?
Okay, so the objective function is the same, right? So if you go to each model, here's your objective function. Your objective function is the same. We co-optimize and minimize energy cost and greenhouse gas responsibility cost. Those two together, that's our objective function in both models. So the objective function really, the function may be different because we have different variables, but the objective is the same for both models, right? Yes.
Emily will take the question on the phone.
Hi, this is Mary Winky at PacifiCorp. I'm sorry if you've already talked about this, but my question has to do with if the resources that are located in the EIM and TBAAs are flagged as ineligible for receiving or for being imported to California, how would that change what some of these models look like, if at all?
It's really not changed. This is controlled by the greenhouse gas bid that these resources submit in the market. Remember, there are two parts to the bid, the capacity, which is a megawatt quantity, and that limits the allocation to that quantity, which I saw it here in the spreadsheet as the greenhouse gas capacity. So the allocation cannot exceed that capacity. So if you put that capacity zero in your bid, you will not get an allocation. So there's no flag. It's really the information coming through the bidder conveys this. So if you allow an allocation, like here we have 200 megawatt for G2, then that means all of the capacity of G2 could receive an allocation if it's economic. And as it happens here for the 3A solution, it does get 200 megawatts of allocation based on the bid price. But if you put zero, then it will not get an allocation.
So, Mary, this is Don. We're proposing no changes. We're proposing no changes to how a resource bids or opts out of being attributed to support California. So, no changes on that. All we're doing is adding a new point for which to measure the attribution. Where it previously was zero, now we have to have that GHG allocation base, but everything else is the same.
Okay, just one follow-up. If the GHG capacity is zero, though, does it influence, you know, as a, say, or a non-participating resource, does the dispatch of that resource, is the dispatch affected?
Okay, so non-participating resources don't have bids.
Right.
Okay, so, non-participating resources, they don't participate in the EIM, so they have no bids, either energy or greenhouse gas cost, and we don't dispatch them. The market leaves them at their base schedule, and they don't receive a greenhouse gas allocation. Now, if you're a participating resource, you're expected to submit an energy bid, and in your greenhouse gas bid, you can indicate whether and by how much you want to serve California load and be subject to the California greenhouse gas regulation through the greenhouse gas megawatt part of the greenhouse gas bid. Okay? And that does not change, as Don mentioned, going from the status quo to this two-pass solution. This is still the same. Are we good on that?
I think so. I will think it through a little bit more.
Sure. Okay. How are we on time? Okay. So let me see here. What's model 4? I think let's jump to scenario 10, which is probably the most complex. So in scenario 10, okay, we also activate generator G4 here, and we also enforce a transmission constraint, a flow gate constraint. And we do that to show you that in the second pass solution, you can have a mixed dispatch. You can have some dispatch that goes above your greenhouse gas allocation base and some dispatch that goes below. So you can have both incremental and decremental dispatch, and we'll show you how the two models behave on that. So we consider a flow gate constraint in the non-California area. So if you want to see the constraint looks like this, so it has 0.6, 0.4, minus 0.1 shift factors for this G2, G3, and G4 generations, okay? So you want to find an optimal solution with zero exports to California as your greenhouse gas allocation base. It's a relatively simple problem here, so you know, I could find out that these generators have to be loaded 100 and 100, but you can also use the model to solve it. So we can do that. We can put zero export to California. Okay. And solve the model. And you'll see that the optimal solution is 300 for G1 and 100 and 100 for G2 and G3. So our allocation base is 100 megawatts for G2 and 100 megawatts for G3. This would be the optimal solution with zero exports to California, okay? And at this solution, the flow gate is binding at its limit, 100 megawatts, okay? So you start with that. Let's reset this to allow now exports to California. And get our solution. Okay, so this is the solution to Model A. Okay, that's the status quo, what we have now. And here you can see that because the generators G2 through G4, they're cheaper than G1, you're going to try to maximize the export to California. Okay. But because of the constraint, because of the flow gate constraint that cannot be violated, its limit is 100 megawatts, you can get 33 megawatts of export into California, but you can't do more because of this flow gate constraint. So actually at 33 megawatts, this is the distribution based on the shift factors. So you can get 33 megawatts out of these resources to get to California to serve 33 megawatts of load, but you cannot do any better than that without violating the 100 megawatt flow gate. Okay, this is what congestion does, right? It limits your optimal solution otherwise. So your optimal solution here is 267 for G1, 33 for G2, and 200 for G3, all right? G4, we have it out of the picture here to simplify the example, right? So it's not running. So when you go to the allocation of the current model, again, it disregards completely what's your allocation base. It will allocate your exports of 33 megawatts to the cheapest resource in terms of greenhouse gas cost, which is G2 because it has a $1 cost. So all the 33 megawatts is going to go to that G2. Okay, so that's the status quo solution. Any questions before I go to the two-pass? All right. So let's see what happens now with Model J, the two-pass solution on this. So the two-pass solution will see that the 33 megawatt of G2 is not an incremental dispatch because its base was 100. So it will not allocate greenhouse gas responsibility to G2 like Model A did. It will try to see if there is another resource which is also cheaper than $40 for serving California load to allocate, and that's resource G3. So it will allocate the 33 megawatts of export, which is the most export that we can have without violating the flow gate constraint. It will allocate this to G3 instead of G2 because G3 has an incremental dispatch. It will not allocate it to G2 because G2 does not have an incremental dispatch. It actually has a decremental dispatch. So here you see an example where the greenhouse gas allocation is less than your incremental dispatch. This is what I was mentioning earlier to Mark from PowerX, that you may have a situation where there is offsetting dispatch outside California because of congestion, so that your net export to California is less than your incremental dispatch. So you don't allocate fully on that. You only allocate 33 megawatts of greenhouse gas responsibility to the 100 megawatt of incremental dispatch for G3. Okay? Now if we look at the prices, in 10A, the price for serving California load is $40. Because G1 is the marginal resource at $40. The price for serving non-California load is $1 less because the allocation is on the greenhouse gas cost of $1, which is the marginal, so it's $39. So you have a $1 difference because the allocation went to G2, because G2 has the lowest greenhouse gas price. But if you look at the two-pass solution, because the allocation went on G3, which has a $4 greenhouse gas price, prices are slightly different. You have $40 for the California load, again set by G1, but you have a $4 differential because the allocation went to a $4 greenhouse gas cost resource. So the marginal price for non-California load is $36. Okay, so you have differences both in dispatch and in pricing between the two models. So I'll stop here and see if there are any questions on this. Okay. And the tool is available to you. You can run your own what-if scenarios. I showed you how you can run it. You have any questions? We expect to see comments from you. All right. Thank you. Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, we'll take them.
Okay, Emily, we'll take the first question in the queue.
Hi, Judge. This is Wedge from SCE. Just want to clarify, in your examples, the flow gate is inside the EIM areas. It's not at the boundary between the CAISO and the EIM, because I know there were also physical constraints on interties, but you're not referring to those constraints?
Yes. Yes, well, you're right. This flow gate is inside the non-California area, and that's why if you see its definition, it doesn't have a shift factor for G1. Basically, G1 is remote electrically to that constraint, so it doesn't have an impact. So it's a constraint that binds G2, G3, and G4. This model has been built with the ability to have actually a constraint on the export, which is a transfer constraint. I haven't activated that in the examples. It just adds another dimension of complexity that they didn't want to go through it with you today. But you can use it as I used it to show you how I can find the greenhouse gas allocation base. Remember, I put zero export bound, and then I solved the problem, and that's how I found the optimal allocation with zero exports. So the flow gate is an internal constraint. What's listed here as an export, you can put a limit there, and that will limit the transfer. That's an additional constraint. For every constraint you add and becomes binding, you have a marginal, you have a saddle price. So in this solution, if you look at the prices, there is a minus $43.3 congestion price for that flow gate constraint. So it's not simple to say the price in non-California area is $36, 40 minus 4. You actually have to add the effect of congestion with the relevant shift factor. So you'll find different prices for G2, G3, and G4 because of congestion, all right?
Yeah, thank you. That makes sense.
You're welcome. That's it? Cool.
Thank you, George.
Okay, so it's Don again. So now I wanted to walk through some additional considerations we need to think through as the ISO becomes a multi-state balancing authority area under the regional integration. And I'll go through each of these topics in one more detail on subsequent slides. But the first one is we need to extend this two-path solution to the day-ahead market. Then when we look at true imports and exports, so this is imports and exports from and to the multi-state balancing authority area, how do you consider those from a California supply or GHG regime supply? The next area is around convergence bidding and how you would consider which GHG regime those are considered part of. And then lastly, how you could actually support if there were multiple programs. So in terms of extending the two-path solution to the day-ahead, since there is no base schedule, I mean, everything starts at zero, this is really the only way that you could address not allocating immediately to all of the non-emitting resources first to California, even though they may have been contracted or used to serve or planned to be used to serve non-California load. And then secondly, we will want, when we think about the simplifications we're making with regards to the first pass in our TD, we're going to want to use those same simplifications when doing this in the day-ahead time frame to maintain some level of consistency. So in terms of taking this methodology to day-ahead, not a heavy lift. Next is on the treatment of imports and exports. So under the current California cap and trade program, gross imports have a compliance obligation. So let's say there were 100 megawatt imports to the ISO and 40 megawatts of exports from the ISO, no wheels at all. Well, the amount of load being served by that 100 megawatt import is 60. So 60 megawatts of California load are being served because the other 40 of that import is actually serving an export, and that export by definition has to be serving non-California load. So under this new approach, we will still consider true imports and exports to the multi-state balancing authority area, but they will also need to be attributed as with any other external supply. And only those that are attributed to have been supporting California load would have a compliance obligation. So what the end result of this is that the total number, and this is just specific to the California Cap and Trade Program, the total number of compliance obligations that will be surrendered is going to be the greater of California load or the dispatch of generators geographically located in California, whatever the higher of those two numbers are. Any questions on that? Go ahead.
I have a question. Angela Tanghetti with the Energy Commission. Is this all of California, L.A., SMUD? Only the ISO?
Only the ISO, okay. Correct.
Okay.
Now let's move to our friends' convergence bids. The key here is we are going to want to treat exactly the same as an internal generator that's serving load within a given state in which they're located. So what that means is that virtual supply does not submit a separate GHG bid adder. So it can't be used to transfer into another GHG regime. So there's no explicit bid. The virtual demand, just like load in another state, is not exposed to the cost of another state's GHG program when that region is exporting power. And then lastly, since we do allow trading hubs and load aggregation points as eligible convergence bidding nodes, we need to make sure that we don't cross over multiple greenhouse gas regimes. So those will all have to be isolated into you won't be able to have a load aggregation point that crosses multiple regimes. Are there any questions on that? Okay, so lastly, what do we need to do to support multiple? Go ahead, Ellen. I'll go ahead.
Sorry, I'm about 1 minute behind thinking as you are talking. On slide 30 about
yep.
trading hubs and LAPs.
Yep.
So, what will you do with trading hubs to ensure that there's only one trading hub per GHG regime?
Again, it's a modeling exercise, so we'd make sure that those generation nodes, that they're only specific to the GHG program associated with where they're geographically located.
So if necessary, will you break apart trading hubs?
If you had one that crossed state boundaries, which we don't have today.
Well, you do today with SP 15, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we would you would need to ensure that you don't have that. Once you get to the multi-state regional issue, you're going to need to make sure that you don't cross that, because then you would mess up the virtual bidding.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll go to the phone.
Emily, can you open up Wade?
Yeah, this is Wade from SC. Just a quick question on the convergence bid.
Yep.
So in the day-ahead market, how do you treat convergence bids for the first pass round? Would you be exclude them in the first pass round, or would you be include them to determine the unit commitment or optimal dispatch without transfer to the California?
You would include them in the first pass, but they can only serve load in the state in which they're located.
Okay. And then in the real time, you will also isolate non-California supply where virtual bids will be taken out, and then do that optimal dispatch. So in other words, the optimal dispatch in real time can be very different than the optimal dispatch in the day ahead because of virtual bid in the first pass run?
No, I don't think the first pass run causes that difference, because even in the second pass, you're going to say that the virtual bid can't support load in another state or another another greenhouse gas program.
So let me make it really simple. Say if you only have virtual demand bid in the non-California state, when you do the day-ahead first pass run, would you be able to dispatch up resources to meet that virtual demand in the first pass and then use that as optimal GHG base to decide?
That's correct. So remember, right, in that first pass, we're only restricting that there can't be transfers into a specific region. There can be transfers out transfers out of that region, as well as other resources outside that region being dispatched up.
Okay.
So, Wei, if we want to break it down to its components, when it comes to load bids, no load bid, actual or virtual, will have a greenhouse gas bid because they will never get an attribution. And when it comes to supply, actual physical supply bids could have a greenhouse gas bid so that they can get an attribution to some greenhouse gas regulation area, but virtual supply bids will not have that attribution, so they will never get an attribution for another greenhouse gas regulation area than the one that they reside.
Question in the room?
Yeah, I think opposite to the example that I gave, I think if you have all the virtual supply meeting the physical loads in the non-ISO area, and then that will make the GHG allocation base for non-California resources really low, and then that may increase the GHG allocation to physical resources in the second pass round. So I have to think more about it, but
okay.
It's not clear to me on the impact.
Okay, thanks.
Kevin Woodruff. I'm running a few minutes behind Ellen and Wei Zhao, so excuse me. I'll make a general observation. Some of these slides, just because you go by them doesn't mean we're all bought into them. We just need to think about them. Question I have on sort of the first two bullets, and you may have actually answered this already, but so someone submits a virtual supply bid.
Mm-hmm.
So they sell it day ahead and they buy it back real time. I've got that sequence right. Okay. That real time price, will there be a couple potentially different real time prices they might buy it back at, or
they would buy it back at the real-time price at the node at which they had submitted that virtual supply bid.
Okay, so okay. And the same is true with demand as well.
You correct.
There'll be one price per node, okay, as you've been demonstrating. Okay, fair enough. Thanks.
Okay, that's right. Okay, so now let's talk about when you have multiple greenhouse gas regimes. And this really only becomes an issue if that greenhouse gas regime puts a compliance obligation on imported energy or puts a compliance obligation on generators outside of their state that serves their load. If it's just putting an obligation on resources within their state, then they simply include that in their energy bid and the market will ensure that their costs are covered. So when you have any generator that's located in that given state would put that state's compliance costs in its energy bid. It would then have a separate greenhouse gas bid adder for any resources to serve any load outside of that regime. We would do the same first pass and second pass approach, where in the first pass, just like we talked about with California only, we don't allow any transfers in or imports, you know, anything coming, any supply coming into that region. So if there was another regime, we would have the same rule. You don't allow any transfers to come into them from either California or the rest of the balancing authority area that doesn't have under a GHG program. And then in the second pass, everybody's back in the pool and we redispatch the whole footprint again, honoring the GHG allocation base that we'd have established in the first pass. So to help with this from a bidding standpoint, let's assume that there's actually two GHG regimes. There's a blue regime and a yellow regime. Both of these regimes put a compliance obligation on external supply when that's serving their load. So you would have generators in the blue region. They would include the blue GHG cost in their energy bid. They would submit a separate greenhouse gas bid to serve the yellow regime if they wanted to serve them. And again, it would be optional, just like what our current approach is. If they wanted to, so they'd submit that separate bid if they wanted to serve load in the yellow regime. The yellow generators would basically do the opposite of that. They would include the yellow costs in their energy bids and submit a separate greenhouse gas bids. Then you've got the gray generators, the ones that aren't under any GHG regime. They don't embed any GHG costs within their energy bid. But in the event that they are willing to be attributed to serving either load in the blue regime or the yellow regime, they submit two separate greenhouse gas bids to be used in the optimization. And then the imports and exports, so these are people outside that multi-state balancing authority area, they're just like gray generators, in essence. They don't have a GHG cost in their energy bid, and they submit separate bids, one to serve the blue regime load and one to serve the yellow regime load. Are there any questions on that? Callie.
And this is Callie Wells with Rosero Consulting. There we go. So I'm going back to the model, and when it looked at which, so I'm looking at considering transfers between the blue and the yellow.
Yes.
And so in the Excel model, when it looked at which transfers from the blue into the yellow, so it considered both the energy price as well as the GHG bid. But now if we have the blue generators in their energy price also including the GHG costs, plus a separate bid of GHG costs to go into the yellow,
mm-hmm.
when you're looking at the cost to transfer from blue to yellow, could there be some double counting of GHG costs?
There could be, and that's one of the issues you have in terms of individual states structuring their mm-hmm. own programs, that they would need to come up with a way to not double ding somebody. And in the event that there was some arrangement between the two regions on how they address the double counting, that would simply reduce the amount that, for instance, the blue generator would bid. They wouldn't bid the full compliance cost as if they were in the yellow program. They would bid whatever the incremental amount that they need to be to cover, if there was a price difference, for instance, in the way that they do carbon.
Okay.
The way that they price carbon.
Okay, so assuming the cost to serve yellow is more expensive than the GHG cost to serve blue, then their separate GHG bid to serve yellow would just be incremental to the blue?
Correct.
Okay, and so then, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. So would there be a way for them, let's just say the cost to serve yellow for whatever reason because of the different GHG regimes, it's actually less expensive. How would they reflect that?
Can I ask?
Yeah, go ahead, George.
For something like that, you would need two different greenhouse gas bids. So you would have, we're talking about a blue generator, right? So you have a blue greenhouse gas bid and a yellow greenhouse gas bid. Okay, and out of your whole dispatch, you could get a portion for allocation for blue, subject to the blue regulation, based on your blue greenhouse gas bid, and a portion for yellow, regulated for the yellow regime, which will be relevant to your yellow greenhouse gas bid. But under this model, that means your yellow attribution will not be subject to blue regulation. So that's what Don was alluding, that it depends on how the cost program will be structured. If it's structured in that way so that you don't have double counting at all, then this will be the model. Otherwise, you'll have a different solution.
Okay, let's go to the phone.
Emily will take the question on the phone.
Currently not seeing any hands up.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And then simply lastly, this is just a visual of what we'd already talked about in terms of that when you do that first pass, you basically do all of the blue regime supply first, or you have to meet blue load with blue regime supply and yellow load with yellow supply. We'll optimize all of the non-GHG region independently first, and then you put it all back together. And you'll get an EIM-based allocation used for doing the incremental transfer into either one of the two regimes. And that's our last slide, except for the calendar. So I'll pause a little to see if there's any questions on the material.
I have a couple sort of broad questions. One of which is, it seems that any sort of attribution of GHG import, you know, GHG imports into California is now, you don't have a separate energy from unit A and GHG from unit B happening anymore?
Right.
Okay, it's now like, okay. The other question I have is whether or not, or how close this proposal is to the way the counterfactual you use now to estimate EIM benefits and GHG impacts. It seems like you're probably closer to that. Maybe you're laying on top of it. I don't really know the details. So
I think there is some resemblance, but the counterfactual tries to see what's the optimal solution if there is no transfer whatsoever between EIM areas too. Whereas here, we're not interested in, we allow transfers among EIM areas as long as they're in the same non-greenhouse gas regulation. So it's really a different counterfactual we're talking about. Okay?
That is no transfers are occurring. In the first pass, we do allow transfers out of, for instance, the ISO. We don't allow transfers in.
Okay, so EIM transfers out or exports out?
EIM transfers.
Okay, so the counterfactual that's used for the dollar reporting, that all takes sort of the base schedules or something, and then operates on those or what?
I think we don't have the right people in the room for that question, but because the base schedules are not optimal, they may be optimized, but they may be optimized with no transfers to the control area.
Okay.
So it's the granularity is different. The philosophy is still the same. You're looking for a baseline,
right?
But your baseline for calculating EIM benefits is different because you're starting from a solution that doesn't have any EIM transfer whatsoever. Each area is on its own, right?
Okay.
Whereas here we group them by regulation, by greenhouse gas regulation area, yes, no.
Okay.
So it's a different, different footprint aggregation.
I think I get it. Thank you.
Okay.
Emily, we'll take the question on the phone.
Hello, this is Ayat. I just have a broad question as well. The model that you presented in the spreadsheet, is that the basis for option two, or is this the bridge solution?
That is what the spreadsheet illustrates is the current methodology, which is what we're identifying as A, and the two-path solution, which is are identified as J, which is option two.
The two-path solution, is it option two for long-term modeling? Okay. So this is not going to be used for 2017, correct?
Correct.
When you're asking for comments, are you just restricting the comments on this model, because I'm still not clear what will be the bridge solution? Maybe we haven't discussed it here, but is that something
you brought up? The bridge solution is something that we will need to work through the ARB process. Since they're open to proceeding to where they wanted to make some changes for 2017, and as we've pointed out, we're not going to be able to implement the option two in 2017, so there may need to be some different approach outside of our market optimization to address that. And there's another comment in the room regarding this.
Hi, this is Andrew Orr with the California ISO, and just to clarify, so ARB in its regulatory process is looking at modifications to its program commencing January 1st, 2018, and I think from our internal assessment, Don and George, you can amplify, we don't think it's feasible to, I think, design, construct, test this two-pass option solution between now and January 1st, 2018. So that's why we've talked about a possible need for a bridge.
Thank you. I'm sorry. So just to clarify, this spreadsheet is in its initial stage, and you're still open for suggestions, modifications, because when I commented earlier, I got the sense that this is kind of a set path, and maybe I misunderstood the response. Is this still under consideration for further design and testing?
So we do anticipate that we will be doing further design and testing because we need to find ways to reduce the solve time of establishing that first pass so that we can continue to use the real-time dispatch effectively to run the grid. So we are when we're looking at the option two, we believe that that is the correct long-term solution, and we are going to be working on identifying ways to reduce the solve time associated with the first pass.
Well, thank you. That makes sense. I guess one more question about so that we can write comments that could be considered if possible. The base case that is considered here in option two, page two, has this, or can you please test this on an already existing scenario, like some solution that you've already seen how the market would run,
and see if this can this model results in the same solution. And I think this is very important to understand the base case or the baseline you're setting to measure up who's responsible or attributed responsible for the GHG cost. So are we going to see some tests of this based on real cases?
So we've tried to show through the spreadsheet illustrative examples. We have not designed, built this approach into our market optimization to be able to do such what-if cases and analysis. And that's where we will, through our normal market simulation, testing, those phases, and, you know, review the various market results and understand on an offline basis how this new approach is performing. And I think that'll be relevant given that the base, the GHG allocation base, we need to find some way to do that in a quick first pass process. And that quickness is what will have you be willing to give up a little bit of precision for still being able to run the grid.
Thank you.
Okay, and there's one more question in the room.
Brian Deering, Ellison, Schneider & Harris. A quick question just on how to engage on the bridge solution. Is that solely within the ARB's court now, or are you looking for comments on that in the context of your process?
We're in the straw, this is Andrew, we're in the straw proposal phase here, I'd say. You know, if you have thoughts about the need for a bridge, given what we know and what we think about the time frame for designing and implementing this, I think we welcome it.
I agree. I think it'd be valuable to, even if you put that sort of comments and considerations in both our process and their process, is probably beneficial. Okay.
Great. Thank you. Great. Thank you, Don. So these are the next steps for this initiative. We are asking for you to submit written comments. So the comments that you provided today, we encourage you to include those in your written comments. Submit those on December 15th. You can submit them to initiativecomments@kaisa.com. And then we'll take a break. And after the holidays, we're going to issue the draft final proposal for this initiative, followed by a call on January 12th. And then, we'll ask for stakeholders to provide written comments on the draft final proposal. We did record the meeting today, so if you want to go back, share it with your families, you're welcome to listen to that recording. It's going to be on the initiative webpage. Look for that at the beginning of next week. Any other questions before we conclude the meeting today? Well, thank you very much for your participation, and we look forward to your comments.